President Trump promises to deport millions of people in the country illegally as the left and right debate whether facilities holding migrants qualify as concentration camps. It's Wednesday, June 19th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon, I'm Jack Lepiarz. Coming up, the former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement weighs in on the pledge as the current acting director issues another warning to migrants today.
Not only will we be enforcing the law, but we're also going to send a powerful message to the individuals in the Northern Triangle country. Do not come. Do not risk it.
Also this hour, the White House rolls back another Obama-era environmental protection, something that could allow coal plants to stay open longer. And three Russians and a Ukrainian face charges in the downing of a passenger plane in Ukraine 5 years ago. It's 4:01. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Environmental Protection Agency has unveiled its replacement for the Clean Power Plan. That's the Obama-era effort to reduce pollution from coal-fired power plants. The new rules will have a big impact on coal-producing states, as Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
The Trump administration's Affordable Clean Energy Plan should not be compared to the Obama-era Clean Power Plan. That's according to Matt Preston, a financial analyst. He says this plan has little to no teeth in enforcing emissions reductions. It focuses on improving plant efficiency rather than emission limits, which Preston says could actually create more emissions.
If you were to improve the efficiency of coal power plants and nothing else changes, then actually the power plants would run more.
Even so, it's a relief to some in Wyoming, the largest coal-producing state in the U.S. Senator John Barrasso says this follows the law while lowering emissions, drawing a contrast to Obama's Clean Power Plan. For NPR News, I'm Cooper McKim in Laramie, Wyoming.
A New York jury has convicted the NXIVM founder accused of running a sex cult in which women were branded and starved. Prosecutors say Keith Raniere was charged with sex trafficking, possession of child pornography, and racketeering, among other offenses. He's due to be sentenced in September. The U.S. envoy on North Korea says negotiations are very much possible, but so far there have been no substantial talks since the failed summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Hanoi last February. We have the latest on this from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
The talks have been in something of a holding pattern, according to U.S. Special Representative Stephen Biegun.
While we and the North Koreans have yet to resume our negotiations at the working level since the Hanoi summit, there have been numerous communications between our two governments, publicly and privately, directly and through third parties.
Asked at a Washington think tank about reports of a purge of North Korean officials involved in the talks, Biegun says that may be overblown, but he notes there have been numerous personnel changes, and it is his job to work with whomever sits across the table. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
A U.S. House panel held a hearing on reparations for descendants of enslaved Africans. Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker testified today in favor of the reparations bill.
I feel a sense of anger where we are in the United States of America, where we have not had direct conversations about a lot of the root causes of the inequities and the pain and the hurt manifested in economic disparities, manifested in health disparities, manifested in a criminal justice system that is indeed a form of new Jim Crow.
The reparations bill is unlikely to get through the GOP-led Senate. Before the close, the Dow was up 38 points. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Boston City Council's weighing a measure to clarify how Boston police interact with federal immigration authorities at today's council hearing. Councillor Josh Zakim introduced an update to the so-called Trust Act, which he says has the mayor's support and will help fight crime.
Often, domestic violence, sexual assault, the perpetrators use the undocumented status of the victim or a relative to cow them into silence, and this should help put a stop to that.
The original act, approved 5 years ago, bars police from holding someone solely at the request of federal immigration authorities. On Beacon Hill, work on a measure to prohibit the use of handheld devices by drivers is entering a new phase. Today, members of a conference committee held their first meeting to work out the differences between House and Senate legislation. Both bills limit drivers to using only hands-free technology, but they differ on a call for police to collect racial and ethnic data at traffic stops for a future possible study on possible profiling. The man accusing Kevin Spacey of groping him at a Nantucket bar claims he cannot find a cell phone he's been ordered to turn over to the actor's attorneys. A Nantucket District Court judge ordered the device to be handed over by Friday. Spacey's lawyers want to try and recover text messages they say that would help his case. The judge is now extending that deadline until July 8th. The state's top securities regulators warning investors to be careful when they put their money into marijuana businesses. Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin says his office is seeing an uptick in the number of fraud cases in the industry. Galvin warns potential investors to be cautious of unsolicited investment offers. He says those fraudulent investments are often sold by unlicensed, unregistered sellers. In sports, the Red Sox will play the rubber match of a three-game set with the Twins in Minnesota. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight, lows around 60 degrees. More clouds tomorrow with showers and rain later in the day, highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 71 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Babbel, a language learning app that uses a spaced repetition method by matching pictures with words and conversational phrases. Babbel's daily 10 to 15-minute lessons are at Babbel, Babbel.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump is promising to deport millions of people in the U.S. illegally starting next week. Today, his acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement gave some details.
Not only will we be enforcing the law, maintaining the integrity of the system, but we're also going to send a powerful message to the individuals in the Northern Triangle country, do not come, do not risk it, because once you get here, once you receive due process and get a final order, you will be removed.
That's Mark Morgan speaking with reporters today. He suggested that thousands of people will be deported, not millions, as the president said. He said first up will be migrant families and others who have received final orders of removal. To talk about what this entails, we're joined now by John Sandweg. He served as acting director of ICE under the Obama administration. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So Morgan says these are people who have had due process, who ICE now has no choice but to deport. How much of a shift would this actually be from what this government has been doing?
Well, historically, other than a brief period of time during the Obama administration, the truth is that there has not been much in the way of enforcement efforts against individuals who came to this country, filed an asylum claim, lost, and were not detained during the process. Candidly, I think that when I was at ICE and during my time at DHS, we just thought that there were higher priority individuals, folks who posed a threat to public safety, you know, that we should dedicate our resources to rather than focus necessarily on this population.
Well, what do you think of this policy?
Well, listen, I do think it's important that we have integrity in our asylum system. And I think the important part that the acting director said is that whether you get a full and fair process. The problem here, though, unfortunately, is that there's a lot of chaos in the system right now. Everybody's dramatically overwhelmed. And there's a very high likelihood that a lot of these people who have a so-called final order of removal never even knew they had a hearing before an immigration judge.
You say that everybody in this process is totally overwhelmed. Setting aside whether it's a good idea or not, is it something that can be implemented? Is there capacity to do this?
It's going to be hard. And look, the question here is what's going to give? ICE only has so many resources. And I think the Trump administration likes to act like they're pushing ICE, you know, in ways whereas the Obama administration was not. But the reality here is that ICE has always operated at 100% of its capacity. So the question is, when you look at who is ICE focusing its enforcement efforts on, as it now takes on this additional responsibility, who are they going to diminish their enforcement efforts against? And I guess my biggest concern would be, are we going to see a diminishment in the focus on individuals with serious criminal histories or coming out of federal prisons or state prisons who actually pose a threat to public safety in order to focus on this population?
So is the crunch with the actual ICE agents who would be finding people and putting them into deportation proceedings, where is the crunch?
Yeah, the entire system. The number of ICE agents who are going to go find these individuals, it's very labor-intensive work to find these individuals. So now when you're out there doing that work, maybe you're not being able to respond to a jail or a prison where there's a serious, you know, violent felony offender being booked. It's also going to be the crunch, though, with the, you know, just in terms of the charter flight network and the detention beds. ICE is already at 52,000 beds. They're only budgeted for 40. So they're already stretching their budget very thin in terms of detention. This is something that has to be done very carefully. When you're talking about a lot of these are going to be family units with minor children. Now, fortunately, unlike the family separation, they will keep the family unit together. But there's no way to do this without some detention of including vulnerable minor children. And that is incredibly sensitive. And what concerns me is, have there been adequate plans put in place to ensure that this is done as carefully as possible?
What do you make of the discrepancy between the acting ICE director Mark Morgan implying that thousands of people are going to be deported and the president saying it will be millions?
I think the acting director's, you know, prediction of thousands of deportations is much more likely than millions. In the most vigorous year of enforcement in ICE history, ICE only removed 400,000 people. It'll be very difficult for ICE to remove anywhere near that level of individuals, no matter how hard the president pushes them.
That's John Sandweg. He served as acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement under President Obama. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The United Nations says every minute of last year, 25 people were forced to flee their homes somewhere in the world. That adds up to a total of nearly 71 million people now forcibly displaced. It's the highest number since the Second World War. Two countries in particular have seen a huge number of newly displaced people. They are Venezuela and Ethiopia. To tell us more, we're joined by NPR's Eder Peralta. He is just south of Ethiopia in Nairobi, Kenya. Hi, Eder.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hey, so who are these people who make up this really staggering statistic, 71 million people?
So the number refers to the people who are displaced. So that means refugees, but also people who have been forced to leave their homes but are living inside their own country. Mm-hmm. The UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, says that in 2018, almost 14 million people were displaced. And as you said, that is the largest number of displaced people since World War II. I was talking to UNHCR's Chana Gedeni Williams, and she says she started working at the refugee agency 20 years ago. And she says since she started, that number has doubled. And that is in part because of the nature of displacement. It's changed. Let's listen to a bit of what she told me.
At least when I started, like with the Bosnian War, the majority of people went back. Same thing with Rwanda. Like we had millions of people going back home. But now what we see is the Syrias, the South Sudans, they're all staying for decades.
Essentially, what Gedeni Williams is saying is that the world is failing to find solutions to displacement crises, so the total number just keeps going up.
Yeah. Let's talk about the countries they are coming from. I mentioned Venezuela, which, well, sad, I guess is not so surprising given the political and economic chaos there of late. But what about Ethiopia? What is the story there?
I mean, it's actually the opposite of Venezuela, because last year, Ethiopia emerged from a prolonged political crisis. And Ethiopians, they now have a prime minister they like and a prime minister who has declared peace with Eritrea, which is their historic rival. But what's also happened is that the popular rebellion that brought Abiy Ahmed to power also left the federal and regional governments weakened. And all of these ethnic conflicts that had been simmering for decades, all of them are coming to a head. So there's just been a lot of intercommunal fighting in Ethiopia, and it's been spread across a huge part of this massive populous country.
Hmm. What does this report have to say about where these people are going to? What countries they're going to? How those countries are coping?
I mean, I think stateside, you guys hear a lot about the record number of people crossing the southern border, your southern border, and seeking asylum. But the fact is that developed countries are not bearing the brunt of this displacement crisis. And that's because the vast majority of people, 4 out of 5 who flee their country, go to a neighboring one. So in my patch, for example, it's Uganda, which is one of the poorest countries in the world, who has taken in more than 1 million South Sudanese refugees. Turkey is hosting 3.6 million Syrian refugees. And the only big Western country among the top 10 is Germany, which has taken about 1 million refugees.
That's NPR's Eder Peralta. He is in Nairobi. Thanks, Eder.
Thank you.
Today, the Trump administration threw its biggest lifeline yet to the ailing coal industry. It's a new rule called Affordable Clean Energy, and it replaces one of President Obama's signature efforts to address climate change. NPR's Jeff Brady joins us now with details. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ari.
So what's the difference between President Trump's Affordable Clean Energy, or ACE as they are calling it, and Obama's Clean Power Plan?
Well, the Obama rule, the Clean Power Plan, it was more sweeping and more specific. It directed states to reduce emissions from power plants by nearly a third by year 2030. It let states figure out how to do that. But for many of them, that would have meant shutting down coal-fired power plants because they emit more greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide, which, of course, contribute to climate change. The ACE rule is more narrowly focused and gives states more discretion. This rule looks at individual power plants and what can be done to make them more efficient. That means under the Trump administration rule, it's more likely that a coal plant currently operating could stay open longer.
The Obama administration's Clean Power Plan actually never took effect because 24 states, many of them coal-producing states, sued to block it. How are people in those states and the coal industry responding today?
Well, they're very happy about this rule change. They thought the Obama administration overstepped its authority under the Clean Air Act with its plan. At the EPA headquarters today, there were some coal workers in their gear and hard hats for the announcement. At one point, they were given a standing ovation. And among the speakers was Michelle Bloodworth. She's head of the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. She said this new rule will prevent more coal power plants from shutting down or retiring, as the industry calls it.
Avoiding additional retirements is so important given that 40% of the coal fleet has either retired or announced retirement, and we expect under the Clean Power Plan there certainly would have been a lot more.
Of course, President Trump campaigned saying that he would help the coal industry, but dozens of plants have shut down since he was elected, mostly because natural gas and renewable energy are cheaper.
And what are environmental groups saying about the new rule today?
They're very critical of this rule. Climate change is on a lot of people's minds now, and they think the country should be doing more to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, not less. Joining the criticism are former Obama administration officials who were involved in writing the Clean Power Plan. Janet McCabe was at the EPA back then.
I think what this rule cements in people's minds is that this administration has no intent of doing anything meaningful to address climate change, which is affecting people and communities across the country now, and that will increase.
Environmental groups and others have already said they plan to sue to challenge this plan. A key question will be how far can the EPA go in setting national policy on carbon emissions? Because there's a sense that this rule change from the Trump administration could make it more difficult for future administrations to take an aggressive approach.
The whole purpose of the Clean Power Plan was to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. How is the country doing on that front?
You know, not bad, actually. The country has almost reached the Clean Power Plan goal a decade early. But the reasons have very little to do with policy. It's more a function of markets favoring natural gas and renewable energy. I've talked with plant owners who say they can shut down a coal plant, build a couple gas plants, produce a lot more electricity, and still have room left over to put some solar panels in an industrial park because they don't have to have all that room to store coal and coal ash after it's burned. So the economics just don't favor coal power plants right now. Still, scientists say that to avoid the worst effects of climate change, we need to reduce emissions a lot more, basically down to nothing within about 3 decades. And many experts say it's difficult to see how that could happen without aggressive federal policies.
That's NPR's Jeff Brady. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Natalie of the Winnetou Resort, Martha's Vineyard. WBUR is on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM, and always on the WBUR Listen app.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Tanglewood. The Boston Pops celebrate Queen with special guest Mark Martel on June 27th. Tickets at tanglewood.org. And Xfinity. Xfinity has a voice remote that lets you search live TV, Netflix, and Prime Video all in one place. More at xfinity.com.
Coming up on WBUR's All Things Considered, how popular restaurants change their neighborhoods. A study of gentrification in LA's Chinatown. On Wall Street today, it was a positive day for the markets. The Dow rose 38 points to close at 26,504. NASDAQ gained 33 points to 7,987. S&P 500 was up 8 points to end the day at 2,926. Marketplace will have all the day's business news coming up at 6:30. Right now, the time is 4:19.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Kimball Fruit Farm in Pepperell, a fourth-generation farm practicing eco-friendly integrated pest management with farmers markets throughout Greater Boston. KimballFruitFarm.com. And New England Honda dealers presenting the all-wheel drive 2019 CR-V and Pilot. You can learn more at HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com. Around here, we Honda.
In the forecast, it'll be mostly cloudy the next few days with a chance of showers and downpours at times. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
A few splashes of sunshine the rest of the afternoon. Otherwise, a lot of clouds and muggy temperatures in the low 70s. Tonight, there might be a shower very late at night down towards 60. In the afternoon tomorrow, showers are possible. Temperature near 70. It's very humid. Better chance for some downpours Thursday night and very early on Friday. Then clouds give way to clearing late in the day. It also dries out on Friday. Temperatures will be in the mid-70s. Saturday, sunshine, mid to upper 70s. Near 80 on Sunday with sunshine.
Right now, 71 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the Alzheimer's Association, working toward a vision of a world without Alzheimer's, providing care and support to all those facing the disease with a commitment to advancing critical research. More at alz.org. And Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That holy grail of New York housing seems to be spreading beyond New York City. New York State has signed sweeping new rent laws that could extend protections throughout the state. Cities such as Buffalo and Rochester can opt in to the new rules, helping protect their renters. Landlords call it a dangerous precedent that will shrink the market of affordable housing. Charles Lane of member station WSHU reports.
The Upper West Side fairy tale of a rent-controlled apartment could be moving north to Newburgh.
There's people living in bedbug city. There's people that's living in mold. There's people that's being locked out. There's people being evicted.
Carla Johnson is showing off all the places she's been evicted from in Newburgh, former industrial town on the Hudson River, 2 hours north of Manhattan. She says most apartment owners in Newburgh do the bare minimum to maintain a unit. If tenants complain, they get evicted.
It's cheaper for the landlord to put you out and move someone else in that doesn't know about the problem.
But new tenant protections may be on the way for cities that embrace the new rules. After Democrats took control of the state Senate, they were able to tweak and expand a law that only applied to New York City. They closed a number of loopholes, allowing landlords to deregulate apartments. But renters outside the city want their officials to adopt these new protections, too. Juanita Lewis is an organizer for the group Community Voices Heard. She's excited to see these new rules possibly spread to other cities in New York State.
There's the, you know, right to make sure repairs are done, or at least being able to have some comfort in making a complaint to, like, buildings and codes and not feeling like you're about to be retaliated against. The rent increases wouldn't be as much. Whereas right now, Newburgh doesn't have any of those things.
Alex Russo follows rent laws around the country for the National Apartment Association, which represents landlords. He says New York now joins Oregon in trying to solve a housing affordability issue.
The trend is spreading to not just the coast, but more and more states. I mean, Colorado had a bill introduced this session. I would predict that Washington will be the next place where you will see this type of policy introduced.
Russo and many economists argue that these type of laws do the opposite of what proponents want, actually making housing less affordable by reducing the supply. In Newburgh, some landlords have an immediate response to the new laws.
It's time to go. It's time to go. How am I going to survive?
Michael Acevedo heads the Orange County Landlord Association. He blames tenants, not landlords, for the poor living conditions.
The tenants kept wrecking it. I kept going in and fixing it. Finally, the mortgage and the taxes were more money than I could rent it for.
Studies suggest that closing the loopholes and protecting pricey $3,000 a month apartments only helps wealthy renters. They show overall rent laws tend to shrink the number of regulated apartments as landlords find new loopholes to deregulate them.
I mean, you know, you go into business to make money. Right? I don't do it for my health. I do it to pay my bills and send my kids to college, you know, whatever.
Even though much of the research shows that rent control doesn't help most tenants in the long run, advocates say at least current tenants are protected. As tenant advocates work to spread these new protections across the state, a coalition of landlord groups will likely lobby cities not to adopt the new rules. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane.
In L.A.'s Chinatown neighborhood, Howlin' Ray's is one of the hottest restaurants, and not just because Chef Johnny Raisone serves up super spicy Nashville hot chicken. Day after day, Howlin' Ray's has a line that stretches around the block.
We heard from someone in the front it's going to be about a 90-minute wait.
Twitter said like an hour and a half.
Have I been to Chinatown before for anything else? Probably not. I think I've only been here for Howlin' Ray's.
So good. This is a religious experience.
Those were Eric Aguado, Micah Smith, Victor Aguado, and Natalie Skeegan, some of the people waiting in line outside the restaurant on a recent weekday.
A lot of the hype around the restaurant comes from social media. Helen Ray's Instagram account has more than 150,000 followers. YouTubers post videos of themselves sweating and crying through boxes of Helen Ray's hottest chicken. Frank Shong is an LA Times columnist who wrote about how restaurants like Helen Ray's are reshaping Chinatown. It's part of a larger conversation about gentrification and what booming urban neighborhoods mean for the people who've lived there for decades. The headline of his recent column, "Many in Chinatown have never tried its most popular restaurant, so I brought the food to them."
Helen Ray's is located in Far East Plaza, which is this kind of double-decker interior type of strip mall. And that plaza has seen a lot of new restaurants in the last couple of years and become kind of this foodie destination that people all want to go to.
Does it feel like a part of Chinatown, or does it feel like something superimposed on this place?
You know, it depends on what version of Chinatown you're talking about. You know, you have the art gallery Chinatown, you have the older traditional Chinatown that consists of this senior population. And then you have this new Chinatown that is being marketed, right? And Howling Rays and Far East Plaza are a part of this new Chinatown.
Safe to say the older residents of Chinatown are not the ones waiting in line for 4 hours for hot chicken at Helen Ray's.
No, but you might find their grandchildren in that line.
So for this column, you bought a bunch of chicken and went around to local folks, local businesses, and literally just passed out the Helen Ray's. How did people react?
Yeah, everyone I talked to has been, you know, intensely curious about how the chicken tastes. And everyone has seen the line kind of curling out of Broadway, out of Far East Plaza sometimes. And everyone walks, so they see it every day. And so everyone was curious to try it. And there was someone who thought it was really tasty. There were some who thought it was, you know, unhealthy, which I guess is a reaction I should have anticipated, you know, feeding it to health-conscious seniors.
I was interested in the reaction of the owner, who seemed very sympathetic to the locals who may not be interested in or able to wait in line for his food.
Yeah, Johnny, when we got up to the counter, he gave us a big box of free chicken and wrote "for the people" on it and asked me to hand it out, you know. And I think in many ways he's heard a lot of the criticisms leveled at him, and in his own way he tries to help. You know, he tries to give out free chicken and be a part of the community in any way. And I think, you know, participating in this story was important to him because, you know, he wants to at least try to do that.
So do you think there is a way for well-intentioned people to bring investment and foot traffic to a neighborhood that has a long history without trampling on that history?
You know, that's a very difficult question, you know. Has any neighborhood really changed or gentrified and not lost something? And we have the type of economy that we do now where you can locate your restaurant in a neighborhood but not really have to interact with any of the residents of that neighborhood because your method of getting customers is through the internet or various different forms of marketing, and people will commute into your neighborhood who don't live there. And so you can have that type of situation now. And so it's more likely that we'll be able to change the way we interact with each other in these neighborhoods than change our entire economy.
Frank Shong writes for the LA Times. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ari.
And for people in Southern California who want some Helen Ray's chicken without waiting in an hours-long line, stand by. Owners Amanda and Johnny Rayzone have announced a second location in a larger space in Pasadena coming in 2020.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, Montana Governor Steve Bullock on his campaign for president in the 2020 Democratic primary. In the forecast, we'll see cloudy skies overnight tonight. Chance of a shower late. Lows right around 60 degrees. More clouds tomorrow with possible showers and rain later in the day and overnight. Highs around 70. Right now, 72 degrees in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Cityside Subaru in Belmont, where the Love Spring event is underway. CitysideSubaru.com, the beauty of all-wheel drive, the beauty of springtime.
A Street Frames, Boston and Cambridge, founded by artists more than 35 years ago, dedicated to the craft of fine art custom picture framing, astreetframes.com. And the Boston Interior Summer event going on now, furniture for every room, professional design service, and 9 locations throughout Massachusetts, bostoninteriors.com.
Millions of Americans are caring for a loved one who suffers from Alzheimer's. One couple in upstate New York is sharing their struggles on a podcast they created.
I became suicidal almost. It was horrible. It was, honey, was it not?
Yeah, you were in bad shape.
How this disease is changing their marriage.
It's almost like having another kid, and Bella resents that.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, pilots are telling Congress they will need more robust training before flying Boeing's troubled 737 MAX airplane again. That's the plane grounded around the world after two crashes killed 346 people. NPR's David Shaper tells us one of the country's most famous pilots is leading the call for more training on the MAX 7.
Retired Captain Chelsea Sully Sullenberger, who safely landed a damaged U.S. Airways jet on the Hudson River in 2009, told the House Aviation Subcommittee that the Boeing 737 MAX plane crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia were preventable.
These crashes are demonstrable evidence that our current system of aircraft design and certification has failed us. These accidents should never have happened.
As Boeing prepares to submit its software fix for an automated flight control system on the 737 MAX to the FAA for certification, Sullenberger says pilots should train on a simulator before flying the troubled plane again, adding that reading about the system on an iPad, as Boeing has suggested, is not even close to sufficient. David Shaper, NPR News.
Someone linked to President Trump's inner circle is taking questions from a House committee today investigating the president and alleged obstruction, but former White House Communications Director Hope Hicks appears to be taking her cues from the White House, which claims she has absolute immunity with respect to her service to the president. California Congressman Ted Lieu says Hicks has refused to answer any questions about her time in the Trump administration.
I think she's fine. I think she is basically relying on the Department of Justice to assert objections every single time it's related to anything during her tenure in the White House. And again, there's no such thing as absolute immunity. The White House is just making stuff up.
Republicans say Hicks is being cooperative and the interview is a waste of time. Stocks finished higher on Wall Street today. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark is supporting the creation of a commission to consider compensation for the descendants of slaves. Clark, a member of the House leadership team, says a commission needs to investigate the stigma and stain of slavery.
To look at the history and to examine what happened and how it is continuing to have a true impact on African Americans and our country in general.
Clark's accusing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of ignoring the impact and legacy of the country's history. McConnell is opposed to reparations. The message coming from the city of Everett and the Encore Boston Harbor Casino is clear. Take public transportation to the resort when it opens this Sunday. Everett Police Chief Steve Mazzi says his department will be prepared.
I believe as we move forward after opening day, everything's going to be just fine. Of course, there's going to be some traffic. A lot of people are excited coming to a new venue.
State police saying they'll have extra patrols in the area and on the Encore property. In the neighboring community of Revere, the mayor there is creating a commission to track the impact that Encore will have on his city. Mayor Brian Arrigo is holding a news conference tomorrow to detail a list of potential impacts. Revere does not have any agreement with the casino's owner, Wynn Resorts, so Arrigo says he wants to be sure impacts on Revere can be addressed and mitigated. Andover residents who live near the intersection of Routes 93 and 495 are looking for help from the state to reduce noise. They've hired a researcher from Boston University to perform tests on the noise from traffic. The results show sound at 5 to 10 decibels higher than what the World Health Organization recommends. They are asking for a state study to be completed by the end of the year. The time is 4:34.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years.
GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
In sports, the Red Sox play the rubber match of a three-game set with the Twins in Minnesota. Eduardo Rodriguez will be on the mound. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight with a chance of a shower late. Lows around 60 degrees. More clouds tomorrow with possible showers moving in the afternoon. Rain overnight tomorrow. Highs tomorrow around 70. Friday, showers in the morning. Clouds the rest of the day. Highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 72 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com. And Subaru, committed to doing its part to make the world a better place by supporting philanthropic initiatives in local communities. Learn more at Subaru.com/lovepromise. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A week from tonight, Democratic presidential candidates hold their first debate over two nights. Montana Governor Steve Bullock will not be on the stage. Bullock says he is not letting that deter his long-shot White House bid, and he argues that as a Democrat who won statewide in Montana, he can help the party win back Republican-leaning voters. NPR Politics podcast host Scott Detrow has the latest from our series of interviews with presidential candidates in conjunction with Iowa Public Radio and New Hampshire Public Radio.
Governor Steve Bullock says one of the biggest adjustments to life as a presidential candidate is how many reporters are suddenly interested in watching you eat. Montana isn't exactly filled with major media markets, so he says he was a little surprised when he went to a brewery immediately after announcing his White House run.
And there are eight cameras watching you drink that beer.
That's part of running for president in 2019, even for candidates like Bullock, who most voters haven't heard of, and who are struggling to hit 1% in polls of a very crowded field. When we sat down in Sioux City, Iowa, Bullock gave his straightforward pitch.
I was on the ballot for re-election in 2016. Donald Trump took Montana by 20. I won by 4. 25 to 30% of my voters also voted for Donald Trump. And if we can't both bring out our base, but also win back some of the places that we lost, we're not going to win this election.
Bullock is in his second term as governor. He thinks his background could appeal to voters who are looking for a candidate who can beat Trump. But Bullock won't be on the debate stage because he didn't hit the polling or donor threshold set by the DNC.
How much are you worried that that'll hurt your campaign?
Well, I can only control the things that I can control. And I got into this in some respects. Some people would say late, even though, you know, we're still 240 days away from any voter actually exercising his or her preference. I got into it late because I had to get my legislature over.
The Montana legislature only meets for 90 days every other year. During this year's session, Bullock got lawmakers to reauthorize a Medicaid expansion first passed in 2015. Since Bullock makes appealing to Trump voters such a big part of his pitch, we asked him why he thought people went from voting for Barack Obama in 2012 to supporting Trump in 2016. He blamed economic instability and the growing gap between the wealthy and everyone else.
Washington, D.C. seems either captured by inaction or big money. I think Donald Trump tapped into something where folks didn't think the economy and the political system was working for him. Now, I don't think he's made it a bit better for any of those individuals.
He says the policies he and so many other Democrats are campaigning on would make things better. Expanding health care, raising the minimum wage, and in Bullock's case, changing campaign finance laws. Bullock says the party needs to just do a better job of selling that message and doing so in the rural and Republican-leaning areas it neglected in 2016.
If I look at the voters that voted for Donald Trump and voted for Bullock, they don't agree with me on every issue or every position. But I think that fundamentally they believe that I'm going to be fighting to try to make their lives better.
He won't be able to make that argument on the debate stage next week, but Bullock's campaign has announced it met the polling requirements to qualify for July's Democratic debate. Scott Detrow, NPR News, Sioux City, Iowa.
No matter who wins in 2020, staffing an administration is a big challenge. It's been especially rocky for this White House. Yesterday, Patrick Shanahan withdrew as President Trump's nominee to be defense secretary after details emerged about violence in his family's past. Last year, White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter resigned over past allegations of domestic abuse. Ronnie Jackson withdrew his nomination to be Veterans Affairs Secretary over allegations that he abused his power as White House doctor, and there are others. Often these issues show up during the vetting process before the president makes a nomination. David Gergen joins us now to discuss why this White House seems to be having so much trouble with the process. He has been an advisor to four presidents of both parties. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Is this happening more often than in a typical administration?
Yes, far more often. And I'm not sure we fully understand why. In this particular, the latest case, the president said he was not informed until 24 hours before Shanahan pulled out. That was just hard to believe. It's either that reflects gross incompetence on the part of his team and not telling him, or he's lying about it, and or it's some combination thereof. But we don't know the answer to that. What we do know is there has been a pattern of withdrawals from nominations that were not fully vetted, or some things popped up at the last minute. You know, both the person that the president wanted to be Army Secretary and the person he wanted to be Navy Secretary were both knocked out by disclosures that had not come up in the early vetting.
So who's supposed to find this stuff out in the early vetting? Whose responsibility is it?
There are two institutions that are responsible, take primary lead for nominees who require Senate confirmation. One, first and foremost, is the White House, working in conjunction with the Internal Revenue Service, working as well with the FBI to do a thorough financial, legal, and personal conduct, and that includes domestic violence kind of search. While that is underway, and it can take a number of weeks, the Senate itself takes up a background check. And so it's almost shocking that the senators are saying they didn't know.
Every administration has some level of dysfunction, but in a White House that is running somewhat more smoothly than this one, how would this work when it's a well-oiled machine or something close to it?
Well, I was involved in a similar case back in the Clinton presidency when we were examining someone for a high position in national security and seemed like a very fine candidate. But then we began to learn things about his past that were troubling. Red flags started to go up. And we went to the president and said, Mr. President, there's some real problems here. This is very problematic. And the nomination soon just disappeared.
So the public didn't know about it at that point?
The public didn't know. It still doesn't know. And I don't think it's fair to the individual. Mm-hmm. His name was never put into play. I think his privacy should be protected since he wasn't seeking a job. He wasn't nominated. Here's the thing that also mystifies me because there's so much about this that's strange. You would think that the candidate himself, knowing how the system works, knowing that there's going to be deep scrutiny, you would think that the potential nominee would go to the chief of staff at the White House and say, we need to talk, and volunteer the information so there can be no misunderstandings about along the way. Instead of having a situation here where people just sat on the information. Clearly, some people knew.
To take a step back for a moment, this administration has more turnover than any in recent memory for reasons having nothing to do with vetting. So given that people are coming and going at a remarkable pace regardless, does it matter if this issue adds to the churn?
Yes, it does matter, especially in national security, because other nations, they send their ambassadors to Washington. They send top people to understand and confide back in the Home Office about what's going on in the United States. What are they going to do next? Can we rely upon them for this or that? And when you have basically a revolving door of people running things, we've had 44, I think the Washington Post count is now, of major high-level people who have left the administration the first 2.5 years. But it's particularly troublesome when it's a domestic position, but when it's national security position and the doors are revolving, it really causes confusion. And people in other embassies or chancellors around the world, they don't know who to talk to. And that creates a lot of gaps, and you can have real misunderstandings in the conduct of national security decision-making.
David Gergen worked for four presidents of both parties, and he is now co-director of Harvard Center for Public Leadership and a CNN senior political analyst. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The United States has a new poet laureate. She is Joy Harjo, the first Native American to hold the position. In making the announcement, Librarian of Congress Carla Hayden called Harjo a champion of the art of poetry whose, quote, inventive lyricism helps us reimagine who we are. Harjo, who is also a musician and a memoirist, what doesn't she do? Well, what she did was speak with NPR's Lynn Neary.
Being named Poet Laureate was exciting but completely unexpected, says Joy Harjo.
I think the first thing that comes to mind is that it's such an honoring for Native people in this country when we've been so disappeared and disregarded, and yet we're the root cultures.
Harjo, a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, has always drawn on Native American myths and stories in her work. She says that's because her culture is just part of who she is, and poetry draws her closer to it.
So it doesn't necessarily become a self-conscious thing. It's just there. You have your culture and you're in it, but you're also in this American culture, and that's another layer. So there's always all of these imprints, but of course the primal imprint for all of us is being a human being on Earth.
As a Native American woman, Harjo says it's inevitable that she would be innately political. But she doesn't view the position of Poet Laureate as political. She says she's always been an ambassador for poetry and wants to continue in that role. But she's also aware that she's taking on a prominent national position at a time of great division in our country. She believes poetry has the power to heal.
Poetry's been one of my fiercest teachers. With language, with sound, shot through with the heart, it becomes a way to communicate. So we're all part of a large poem, a large story. And if you look with perspective, the story all fits together. And one way to find those connections is with poetry.
This excerpt from the poem The Fight reflects Joy Harjo's desire to find common ground.
I grow tired of the heartache of every small and large war passed from generation to generation. But it is not in me to give up. I was taught to give honor to the house of the warriors, which cannot exist without the house of the peacemakers.
Harjo is the author of 8 books of poetry, with a new collection due out in August. She has also written a memoir, and at the age of 40, she took up the saxophone. Now, when Harjo performs, she often sets her own poetry to music and includes Native American instruments and musicians.
I think of the lush stillness of the end of a world, sung into place by singers and the rattle of turtles in the dark morning.
Harjo doesn't yet know exactly what she wants to do as Poet Laureate, but she's got some ideas.
One thing I've always wanted to do is have a cowboys and Indians poetry reading. There's a lot of Indian cowboys and vice versa, I'm sure. So I really believe if people sit, you know, together and hear their deepest feelings and thoughts beyond any political divisiveness, it makes connections.
Joy Harjo takes over as Poet Laureate in the fall, succeeding Tracy K. Smith, who held the post for 2 years. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's Graduate Tax Program. Advance your career with an LLM or master's degree in tax law open to tax, legal, and business professionals. And LaSalle Village in Newton, engaging retirement living on the LaSalle College campus. Call now for available one-bedroom units. LaSalleVillage.org.
This is WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, Dutch prosecutors announce murder charges against 4 people in connection to the downing of a Malaysia Airlines flight in 2014 that killed nearly 300 people. Remember, Edify is WBUR's home for education news with stories online at WBUR.org with funding from Inversant, empowering families to invest in higher education.
WBUR supporters include Pentel Surfaces, full line of Pentel Quartz Surfaces at their new Mansfield showroom off I-95 and I-495, PENTALSurfaces.com. DCU, Digital Federal Credit Union, where you can get low rates on car loans, mortgages, credit cards, and more. What can DCU save you? DCU.org. And the Museum of Science. Tickets on sale now for Body Worlds and the Cycle of Life. Get the inside story on your body at this life-changing exhibition, MOS.org.
I'm Lisa Mullins, anchor of WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm grateful every day for the support we get from listeners. And since this is Member Appreciation Week on WBUR, here's a special thank you to everyone who's given to the station. You make the stories you hear on WBUR possible, including our series this month on the future of food and our story on how we get a handle on food waste. Thank you for giving us the resources to report on issues that matter to all of us.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 5 years after Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over Ukraine, charges have been filed. Today, three Russians and a Ukrainian were charged with the murder of 300 passengers and crew who died on the plane. Reporter Terry Schultz says the prosecution is going ahead despite doubts that the accused will ever appear in court.
Dutch prosecutors have set a trial date of March 9th for Igor Girkin, Sergei Dubinsky, Oleg Pulatov, and Leonid Karshenko, the first four suspects to be named criminally responsible for the deaths of almost 300 people, passengers on an aircraft shot out of the sky during a flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur by what international investigators say was a Russian-made Buk missile. It was launched from eastern Ukraine, an area under the control of separatists backed by Moscow. Investigators say the missile was launched from a vehicle belonging to Russia's 53rd Anti-Aircraft Missile Brigade. Tapped phone calls, along with radar data, open source photos, video, social media entries, and testimony from some 300 witnesses, now have led investigators to the three former Russian military and intelligence officials, and a Ukrainian national who worked with them in the breakaway region. Dutch public prosecutor Fred Vesterbeke says the team expects to name more suspects, which might include active duty Russian officers, but says it's a painstaking process.
We have now the information and the proof in our dossier, in our file, to take the step that we are going to take now against the four people we mentioned. For others, we are not that far at this moment.
Today, Moscow reiterated its denial of any involvement in the shooting down of MH17. Vesterbeke rejects that.
The Russian Federation is involved in this tragedy, in this crime, in one way or the other. One day after 17th of July, they could have been in the position to tell us exactly what happened, because they know.
But what they know may never be heard in the Dutch court. While international arrest warrants are being issued for the four accused, Russia does not extradite its citizens. Prosecutors say they'll request the suspects be handed over under the terms of a mutual legal assistance agreement, but they admit that's a long shot. Still, they said, at the beginning of their investigation, plenty of people thought they'd never even get this far. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
Nearly every day on this program, we talk about the European Union, whether it's the UK leaving the EU or refugees crossing borders or trade fights and the rise of right-wing politics. We rarely talk about the massive bureaucracy that keeps the European Union running. The people of that bureaucracy are the subject of a new, darkly comedic novel by the Austrian writer Robert Menasse.
And I tried to speak so many civil servants as possible, and I wanted to understand how they think, how they live, how is their daily life, why they are failing, and so on.
Menasse spent 4 years in Brussels examining the absurdities and contradictions of the EU through the eyes of its civil servants. His novel is called The Capital. It has a huge cast of characters, and the story includes murder, romance, tragedy, and plenty of absurdity with hints of Veep or The Office. Menasse told me he wanted to write this book because of a gap in his own knowledge.
I suddenly thought, I have no idea what's going on there, how it works, how is the system, the institutions, who are the persons who are working there, what kind of ideas do they have? So I decided to go there and have a look. And my question was, if it is possible to make literary figures out of civil servants.
On this program, as we cover the news, we talk a lot about the way the European Union does or does not work. What do you think a novel can show us that those news reports might not?
It can tell the stories of the involved people. For the majority of the European citizens, European Union is a very abstract thing. And they have no idea how it works and why so many things are not working. I wanted to see the people who are involved in this politics.
After you spent all of that time with the bureaucrats who run the European Union in Brussels, did you come away more optimistic or pessimistic about the future of this coalition?
They made me optimistic. I started to admire them. But at the same time, I got very pessimistic because of the contradictions produced by the national egoism of several member states.
You mean the nationalism that is taking hold across much of Europe right now?
Yeah, this is the basic contradiction of European Union. We have a post-national development since more than half a century. We have a single market. We have a common bureaucracy. We have open borders. So we have evidently post-national politics. At the same time, we see the way nationalism in almost all the member states. And you can't have both at the same time. You can't be pregnant and not pregnant at the same time. You can't be a little pregnant. So are we pregnant with future, or have we a disease of the history?
There are moments when it feels like you are leading the reader down a path of scoffing at the European Union and its bureaucracy. And just when the reader starts to feel smug about it, you kind of abruptly pull back and remind us of times when Europe was so deeply divided and millions of people were killed due to that division. It's a very hard pivot.
Yeah, but this is the real situation. This must be understood. The European Union is at the same time a slowly happening revolutionary project. You can't be member of the European Union without accepting the Human Rights Charter as constitutionally basic. And this is, in my opinion, a real political revolution. And this is what is there so interesting.
I sense that you love the European Union the way many people love their family members, which is they drive them crazy and they can't stand them and they make them roll their eyes and they get exasperated, but they couldn't live without them.
I'm proud of being European. At the same time, you can believe me, I'm suffering enough with the contradictions and the problems we have here in Europe. At the same time, don't forget I'm Austrian. I'm the citizen of a very small country. And small countries have the problem of being a little bit not that open to the world. And it is opener now, which result of the European politics in the last decades is definitively a lucky case.
Robert Manasseh, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yes, I hope it was helpful.
It was. His new novel is called The Capital.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for small businesses with features to automatically route and provide custom messages to callers. Uma, the smartphone for your business. More at ooma.com. Teradata, committed to transforming the way business works through the power of data. Teradata leverages data across the enterprise on a single platform to deliver answers to today's complex business issues. Teradata.com. And Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Metamucil Premium Blend contains plant-based psyllium fiber, is made with natural flavors and colors, and is sweetened with stevia leaf extract. Learn more at Metamucil.com.
This is WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up next hour on All Things Considered, the hundreds of African migrants crossing the southern border to seek asylum and why so many of them have wound up in Portland, Maine. That story and more in the next hour here on WBUR. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight, chance of a shower late, lows around 60 degrees. More clouds tomorrow with possible showers and rain later in the day and overnight, highs around 70. Friday, we'll see showers in the morning, maybe a downpour, and then clouds the rest of the day, highs in the mid-70s. Right now, it is 72 degrees in Boston at 4:59.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Members of Congress demand more information on Iran as the White House tries to claim a link between the country and al-Qaeda. It's Wednesday, June 19th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Jack Lepiarz in for Lisa Mullins. Coming up, some members of Congress say any military action in Iran would require a new authorization of force. One Democrat says he's worried the nation could be stumbling towards war.
We could have something lead unnecessarily to a conflict without meaning to. That's what worries me.
Also this hour, Venezuela's opposition leader faces scrutiny over allegations that his representatives in Colombia misappropriated money. And the UN report on the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi points the finger at Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. It's 5:01. First, this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The Trump administration has finished a significant rollback of former President Obama's key effort to address climate change. NPR's Jeff Brady reports critics of the Clean Power Plan claimed it overstepped the president's authority under federal law.
President Trump was elected promising to help the coal industry. This rollback is his latest effort to do that. The Clean Power Plan required states to reduce overall greenhouse gas emissions from the power industry. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler says this new rule gives states options to reduce carbon dioxide from individual plants.
The Affordable Clean Energy Rule, ACE, give states the regulatory certainty they need to continue to reduce emissions and provide affordable and reliable energy for all Americans.
The coal industry says it will allow some coal-fired power plants to continue operating. Environmental groups vow to fight the new rule in court. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Former White House Communications Director Hope Hicks is on Capitol Hill today for a closed-door meeting with members of the House Judiciary Committee. The interview is part of the panel's investigation of President Trump and obstruction of justice. Hicks is the first testimony lawmakers on the committee have heard from someone linked to Trump's inner circle since the release of special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia report. It's not clear how much information she'll provide, though, with the White House saying she is absolutely immune with respect to her service to the president. Hicks is being accompanied by a White House lawyer. The Federal Reserve left interest rates unchanged today, but as NPR's Scott Horsley explains, the central bank signaled a willingness to cut rates in the near future if necessary to prop up the U.S. economy.
Since the Fed's last meeting in early May, we've seen trade tensions ratchet up, continued signs of weakness in the manufacturing sector, and a disappointing jobs report. All of that was not enough to prompt a rate cut from the Federal Reserve, but central bankers are keeping a wary eye on the horizon. The Fed said in a statement that while it continues to see economic growth as likely, uncertainties about that outlook have increased. The central bank says it will closely monitor economic indicators and act as appropriate to sustain the expansion. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues have been under steady pressure from President Trump to reduce interest rates. Critics say the president should keep hands off the central bank because the Fed needs to stay independent of politics in order to do its job. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. trade negotiator Robert Lighthizer says he's willing to work with lawmakers sooner rather than later to address concerns over a new North American trade deal. Lighthizer saying today he believes some of the main concerns on the part of Democratic lawmakers over enforcement of labor and environmental provisions in the proposed U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement can be tackled quickly. Lighthizer made his remarks today in an appearance before the House Ways and Means Committee. Stocks moved higher after the Fed's announcement today. The Dow closed up 38 points at 26,504. The Nasdaq was up 33 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. This hour, prosecutors in the Dominican Republic are expected to release preliminary results in their investigation into the shooting of former Red Sox star David Ortiz. The Dominican's attorney general is promising to share all the information he has on the June 9th attack in a Santo Domingo bar. Ortiz, meantime, is in good condition at Mass General Hospital. A Boston man convicted for a murder in Roxbury in 2007 will get a new trial. State's highest court today ruled that the judge made several errors in the case against Demetrius Wardsworth, including allowing hearsay and failing to guide jurors through certain evidence. Suffolk County District Attorney's Office is reviewing today's decision. The closest casino to Boston's opening Sunday in Everett, and police, city leaders, and executives at Encore Boston Harbor want getting to and from the location to be as easy as possible. WBUR's Quincy Walters reports.
The message? If you want to have fun on Sunday, be patient and leave your car at home. At a press conference today, Everett Mayor Carlo De Maria touted the transportation options to get to the casino.
There will be free shuttles from Malden and Wellington stations on the Orange Line. There are park and ride services coming from north, west, and south with Premium Motor Coach, Millbury, Rockland, and Londonderry. There are water taxis to and from Boston.
Casino executives say they expect over 50,000 people to show up on Sunday. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Quincy Walters.
A lawyer for the man accusing actor Kevin Spacey of groping him in a Nantucket bar says his client cannot find the cell phone the court has ordered him to give to the actor's attorneys. The defense says there are text messages on that phone that'll support Spacey's case. The judge is extending the deadline from this Friday to early next month. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight, chance of a shower late, lows around 60 degrees. Right now, 73 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Metamucil Premium Blend contains plant-based psyllium fiber, is made with natural flavors and colors, and is sweetened with stevia leaf extract. Learn more at Metamucil.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. And we begin this hour with the most complete accounting to date of the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He died last fall at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And a UN report out today, the culmination of a months-long inquiry, concludes both that Saudi Arabia is responsible and that the evidence should compel further investigation into the role played by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Now, those findings alone are not startling. The CIA also believes the Crown Prince was involved, but the report also includes new details about what happened inside the consulate that day. The UN official in charge of this report is Agnès Callamard, and she joins me now from Geneva. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your report concludes it's inconceivable that the Saudi Crown Prince wasn't at least aware of this attack on Jamal Khashoggi. How did you come to that conclusion?
All of the evidence I have collected point to the responsibility of the state of Saudi Arabia. So that was a state-sponsored killing. The notion that the murder of Mr. Khashoggi was a rogue killing simply is belied by the evidence.
And but to be clear, you found no smoking gun that the Crown Prince directly ordered this?
This is outside my mandate. I am conducting a human rights inquiry, not a criminal investigation. Nevertheless, what I have found is that there is sufficient evidence demanding a follow-up criminal investigation with regard to the Crown Prince.
Did Mohammed bin Salman talk to you or your team?
No. Unfortunately, despite my repeated request to Saudi Arabia, they never responded positively to my request to go to Saudi Arabia, meet with the prosecutor there and with anyone else involved in the investigation. My investigation, however, benefited from the support of the Turkish authorities as well as from a range of other governments.
Mm-hmm. The Turkish authorities, for example, gave you access to tapes, to recordings that were made.
Absolutely. 245 minutes of recording, which concern the 2 days that preceded the murder of Mr. Khashoggi and a recording of conversation just before his killing and during his killing.
I want to warn people listening that the answer to this next question may be hard to listen to and may not be appropriate for everyone. But what new details can you add to our understanding of how Jamal Khashoggi died?
Mr. Khashoggi entered the consulate. What you can hear in his voice, particularly at the beginning, of course, is happiness. He was entering the consulate for the purpose of getting documents to get married. Over the next 7 minutes, you can hear the fear growing in the sound of his voice.
I hate to ask you about this, but there is audio where you can hear him being called a sacrificial animal. You can hear talk about joints being separated.
Absolutely. So that is also evidence, in my view, of premeditation. Before Mr. Khashoggi was actually killed, there is a discussion involving the forensic doctor and a description of how a dismemberment could be done. That conversation ends with a question: has the sacrificial animal arrived? That, of course, is Mr. Khashoggi.
Saudi Arabia has responded to your report. The Minister of State for Foreign Affairs was on Twitter saying, there's nothing new here. Given that they wouldn't let you come visit Saudi Arabia, they wouldn't let you interview the leadership, what hopes do you have that a new international investigation will actually advance our knowledge of this?
Look, the investigation that I am suggesting is not like mine. It's got to be focusing on individual criminal liabilities, and it should identify mechanisms through which people individually responsible for the crime can be held to account. Secondly, I would like to insist that to pay homage to Mr. Khashoggi, to ensure that his killing is not to be repeated, Saudi Arabia must demonstrate that they are taking steps not to repeat the crime.
Agnès Callamard, thank you.
Thank you very much.
She is Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, or Arbitrary Executions for the UN Human Rights Office. She was talking there about her report out today on the killing of Jamal Khashoggi.
As the U.S. sends more troops to the Middle East, lawmakers are concerned about the prospect of a military conflict with Iran and whether the Trump administration believes the White House can legally go to war. There is ambiguity created by the open-ended congressional authorization to use military force passed after 9/11. NPR's Tim Mak has more.
The Capitol is on alert after attacks on shipping in the Gulf of Oman, which the Trump administration has blamed on the Iranian government. But another major question has been whether the Trump administration has the authority to use military force against Iran. In a broadly worded resolution passed in 2001, Congress granted the president authority to wage war against those who harbored organizations responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Lawmakers are concerned that the Trump administration, drawing on links between al-Qaeda and Iran, could use that legal authority, known as an AUMF. Here's Democratic Senator Ron Wyden.
Led by John Bolton, there are people in this administration who have hardly ever found a cause that they didn't want to start a war over.
In a meeting last week, Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz said that the Trump administration believes it could act without Congress.
The notion that the administration has never maintained that there are elements of the 2001 AUMF that would authorize their hostilities toward Iran is not consistent with my understanding of what they said to us.
Objection to the possible use of this authority has created bipartisan coalitions. Concerned Veterans for America, a group on the right, and Vote Vets, a progressive organization, have teamed up on this issue, as has a bipartisan War Powers Caucus that formed this week. And today, lawmakers questioned Brian Hook, the State Department's special representative for Iran. Hook repeatedly refused to rule anything out.
We will do everything that we are required to do with respect to congressional war powers.
In fact, Hook declined even to answer basic questions about the Constitution. Here he is being questioned by Representative Ted Lieu.
Under the Constitution, the framers gave Congress the power to declare war, correct? Just a yes or no.
My understanding is that we're here to talk about Iran foreign policy, which I can do.
In both the House and the Senate, bipartisan efforts are now underway to make sure Congress's voice is heard on Iran. Tim Mak, NPR News, Washington.
We'll turn now to one member of Congress keeping an eye on rising tensions with Iran, Alyssa Slotkin. She's a Democrat from Michigan. She was a CIA analyst in Iraq, and she served in the Defense Department under both President Obama and President Bush. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Start with Iran. Do you believe the Trump administration is laying the groundwork for war?
You know, I think it's really hard to understand what they're doing. You have different members of the administration saying different things on different days. The president says he does not want war, but then tweets, you know, a couple weekends ago that he essentially wants to wipe them off the map. Secretary Pompeo says he doesn't want war, but he has a 12-point plan. So, you know, it's hard to understand what their goals are. It's hard for us. So you can imagine how hard it is for the Iranians.
How great a threat do you believe Iran currently poses to the national security of the United States?
Well, I think certainly to our embassies, and particularly in Baghdad, our troops that are stationed in the region, they participate in, you know, significant amounts of terrorism and malign activities from Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon. I mean, they are not positive actors in the region. That is for sure. That doesn't mean that the United States is looking to get into a long-term war with Iran. Right? There's a difference. And what worries me is that this kind of cycle of escalation requires a very, very deft hand. And this administration has not given me evidence that they are capable of that. That's what worries me.
And what would have to happen? What would the Trump administration have to do to persuade you that military action was warranted, was necessary to counter this threat?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that if the administration wants to get into a medium to long-term war with Iran, they need to come back to the U.S. Congress and request authorization for military force. They do not currently have that authority. You know, we always retain the right to self-defense. That is important. If we are being attacked, if our forces are being attacked, we have the right to defend ourselves. That is different than getting into a medium to long-term war, another large war in the Middle East. Some of the intelligence that's out there is compelling, and it would get the attention of any president, any administration, including Republican and Democratic administrations that I've worked for. That doesn't mean that we have a strategy, a plan, and a deft hand in dealing with it.
I mentioned you worked for the CIA in Iraq. Given how wrong the intelligence was in the run-up to war in Iraq, does the U.S. now have a responsibility to its allies, but also to just the American public, to be more transparent about what it knows and how it knows it?
Absolutely. Anyone of my generation, you know, what has absolutely shaped our experience is 9/11 and the aftermath of that, and how we went to war, and how we are still in war. That has shaped us to such an extent that when I look at any future conflict, I have a much more skeptical eye towards the intelligence, the goals, the strategies, how we're going to get out of that conflict. And that's appropriate given the amount of blood and treasure that we have spent in the Middle East in the past two decades.
The backdrop to all of this is a Defense Department that has been without a permanent leader for months now. How does that affect this moment?
Well, in a standard administration, Democrat or Republican, you'd have a robust interagency process. You know, you'd have a Situation Room meeting probably pretty regularly with the president, his national security advisor, his senior cabinet members, and you'd be able to debate, to discuss, to come up with a real plan. I'm just not sure that's even happening anymore. There's no real evidence that a normal interagency process is happening. So I don't know what the process is within the White House to think through these issues.
Michigan Democrat Alyssa Slotkin. She sits on the House Armed Services and on the Homeland Security Committees. Congresswoman, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's Graduate Tax Program. Advance your career with an LLM or master's degree in tax law, open to tax, legal, and business professionals. And the Seacrest Beach Hotel, Falmouth. Beachfront rooms on a private stretch of Old Silver Beach, ocean view dining, white sand, sunsets. SeacrestBeachHotel.com.
This is WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, Venezuela's opposition leader faces new scrutiny amid allegations that his representatives misappropriated money in Colombia. On Wall Street today, a positive day for the markets. Dow was up 38 points to close at 26,504. NASDAQ rose 33 points to 7,987. S&P 500 up 8. The time is 5:19.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New England Honda dealers, presenting the all-wheel drive 2019 CR-V and Pilot. You can learn more at HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com. Around here, we Honda. And Greeno brand storytellers, messaging, media, and marketing professionals for the healthcare, life sciences, and robotics industries. GreenOUGH.biz.
Remember, coming up at WBUR City Space on Thursday, July 11th, July 18th, rather, an evening of salsa music and dancing featuring Cuban Latin jazz band Clave and the Blues. Details at WBUR.org/cityspace. In the forecast, we've got showers moving in tomorrow. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Certainly warm this evening across the area. Temperatures around 70, falling through the 60s late tonight. It continues humid all night long. Just the chance for a quick shower. Tomorrow, showers become likely in the afternoon. It's not going to rain all the time. We'll be around 70. Humidity is high. Thursday night, showers, maybe a thunderstorm and a downpour. They come to an end on Friday. We're in the mid-70s Friday. Then it turns drier by the afternoon and evening hours. You'll definitely feel it. Saturday and Sunday, plenty of sunshine. Mid to upper 70s Saturday, near 80 on Sunday. Great sleeping weather this weekend.
Right now, 72 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980. Proud supporter of independent thought, whether that's online, over the air, or in a bottle. More at sierranevada.com. And the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How old are we when we hit our prime, work-wise? That elusive peak when we have enough experience to know what we're doing and enough energy still to get it done. Arthur Brooks takes on that question in a new essay in The Atlantic. His research and data point to a pretty depressing conclusion that for most people in most fields, professional decline starts earlier, years earlier than we've been led to think. Arthur Brooks, welcome.
Hi, Mary Louise. It's great to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Before we get to the data, is there a story for why you started digging into this?
There is. You know, about 4 years ago, I was sort of on top of the world professionally. Things were going great for me. I was the president of the American Enterprise Institute, a position that I'll have for the next week and a half or so.
We'll get to that. A big think tank in Washington.
A big think tank in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
It's a great place. I was writing books that people read. Things couldn't have gone better. But I had an experience where I was sitting in front of a guy, an older gentleman on a plane, and he was talking to his wife, and I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but I couldn't help but hear. And he was saying he wished he were dead. And I thought it was somebody who must have been really disappointed about his life. But then at the end of the flight, he stood up and I recognized him as somebody who was really quite prominent and who'd done a lot with his life. And I thought to myself, what's he doing wrong? Maybe nothing.
Right. If this guy isn't happy and
feeling
in his prime.
Maybe nothing, you know, you know, maybe there's some science behind it. So I decided to figure out how after 50, life can get better and more fulfilling. And I think I found the answers.
There's scientific evidence that our abilities professionally decline earlier than we all had been hoping.
In virtually every field, we find that people decline before they think they're going to decline. There's a reason that the mandatory retirement age for air traffic controllers is 56 years old. They peak out in their ability to do that high concentration mental work. And it tells us something about the way that the human brain works, something that's very depressing at first, but it turns out that it can be illuminating and even really encouraging once you dig a little bit deeper.
And you also found this varies actually pretty hugely across fields.
Yeah.
You write about the difference between something called fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence.
That's right.
Explain.
So people start off their careers relying on their fluid intelligence, that analytic speed, our ability to figure stuff out fast. That's fluid intelligence. But it tends to
start. So an example being what? What's your job?
Oh, a lawyer, for example. If you're in any sort of business early on, I mean, it's just like clicking fast. That's something that will distinguish you, that will set you apart, that will make it possible for you to succeed in a big way. The problem is that fluid intelligence naturally starts to decline, and precipitously so, starting in one's early 30s. And that's the reason that lawyers will feel in their 40s and 50s they'll notice they've missed a step.
Now, but accumulated wisdom, does that point
that's the important thing. This is the point
Go
that
there.
You're making. Now, people will rage against the decline in their fluid intelligence, but they're missing something really big, which is that curve may be going down, but there's another curve that's going up that's called crystallized intelligence. That's your stock of wisdom. That's the vast library that you're accumulating, all the books in your library that are your mind, and your ability to use them with wisdom, that increases through your 40s and 50s and 60s and stays high if you got your marbles through your 70s and 80s. And that's what you need to rely on. You need to, here's the key, here's the trick, Mary Louise. You got to stop being an innovator and start being an instructor.
An instructor.
An instructor is somebody who synthesizes ideas and expresses them in new and interesting ways that people can understand, that enriches other people, that you can bring other people, you can literally be a teacher. But stop trying to achieve the Nobel Prize winning paper and start thinking about how others have done things and how the patterns all come together. That is truly one of the great strategies of the happiest people who've ever lived.
So how is all this shaking up for you? We mentioned you are head of a big D.C. think tank, American Enterprise Institute. Doing great. You're how old, if I may ask?
I'm 55. I just turned 55 years old.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
How are you applying this to you?
I started this project because I wanted to know what I should do by about the age of 55.
And
I determined that it was after about 10 years in my position as the chief executive of the American Enterprise Institute, it's important to move into something else and to hand the keys over to somebody else. So a new president will be taking over starting July 1st. And I'm going to go to Harvard and teach at the Kennedy School and Harvard Business School and work with students and write books. And life is sweet and I can't wait.
Arthur Brooks, he is outgoing president of the American Enterprise Institute, talking there about his article, "Your Professional Decline is Coming Much Sooner Than You Think." Arthur Brooks, thank you.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
It's been nearly 5 months since Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido launched his campaign to oust Nicolas Maduro and take over as interim president, all with U.S. support. Throughout this campaign, Guaido has called attention to corruption in the Maduro government that's been going on for years. Now, Guaido faces a corruption scandal of his own. To tell us about it, we are joined by NPR's Philip Reeves. He was recently in Venezuela and is now back at his base in Rio de Janeiro. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
So this corruption scandal involves allegations not against Guaido himself, but against two of his party officials. Tell us about them.
Yes, they've been unearthed by the Pan Am Post. It's a website based in Miami that offers news and commentary from the Americas, and it actually supports Guaido. It's published a story about two named officials from Guaido's party. This alleges that these two officials misappropriated funds and squandered many thousands of dollars on hotels, nightclubs, clothes, and other luxuries. The story says that these two did this in Colombia, where they were in charge of managing some of the funds sent to support the hundreds of Venezuelan security forces who've abandoned Maduro and crossed over from Venezuela into the border city of Cúcuta. The deserters started, I'm sure you remember because you were there, I think.
Yeah, I met with some of those deserters, yeah.
Right, and they started arriving in February. They've been living in hotels. There have been difficulties over who pays their bills. And one of the Pan Am Post allegations is that one of these two officials was claiming back money from Guaido's administration for hotels that were actually being paid for by the Colombian government or by the UN Refugee Agency.
How damaging is this to Guaido, who, as we mentioned, has waged this campaign based on the fact that his opponent is corrupt, he alleges?
Yeah, I mean, the amount of money involved is, you know, tiny in comparison with the massive sums that officials from the Maduro government are widely known to have purloined over the years. But, you know, this is damaging. I mean, Guaido and the U.S., who supported his bid to take power throughout, lay great emphasis on the fact that he's, you know, he's a newcomer to Venezuelan politics, you know, a young man untarnished by Venezuela's endemic corruption who's there to clean the place up. This also, I think, undermined Guaido's efforts to persuade the military to switch sides, which is critical if Maduro's eventually to fall. So right now, Guaido's doing, you know, a lot of damage control. He says he's asked the Colombian prosecutors to investigate, and he's talking about full transparency. His officials are saying that this allegedly misappropriated money wasn't, in fact, humanitarian aid to Venezuelans, but came from private donations. Interestingly, though, his envoy in Colombia, Guaido's envoy there, says he began looking into this 2 months ago after being tipped off by Colombian intelligence. So there is speculation that Guaido may actually have known about this for a while.
Those Venezuelan military defectors are always vocal. What have they said about the revelations that money that was supposed to support them was instead used to buy luxuries for the people who are overseeing them?
Yeah, we've been in touch with one of them today who's clearly upset. He's highlighted the risks taken by Venezuela's military and security personnel, who've been mostly junior, when they decide to switch sides. For instance, you know, relatives back home who are being persecuted and sometimes imprisoned and tortured. However, this particular man does continue to support Guaido. I should say that, too.
NPR's Phil Reeves speaking with us from Rio de Janeiro. Thank you, Phil.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, why so many African migrants are crossing the southern U.S. border to seek asylum. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight, chance of a shower late, lows around 60 degrees. Right now it's 72 degrees in Boston at 529. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by BU School of Social Work, offering a top-ranked Master of Social Work degree program, a fully funded doctoral program, and professional education programs that take your social work career to the next level. Become a change maker and visit bu.edu/SSW. And Adelaide of Newton Center, a benchmark mind and memory community coming soon, bridging the art of relationships with technology and programs for dementia. AdelaideNewton.com.
Millions of Americans are caring for a loved one who suffers from Alzheimer's. One couple in upstate New York is sharing their struggles on a podcast they created.
I became suicidal almost. It was horrible. It was, honey, was it not?
Yeah, you were in bad shape.
How this disease is changing their marriage.
It's almost like having another kid, and Bella resents that.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement confirms they're targeting migrant families for deportation, but as NPR's Joe Rose tells us, the numbers may be far smaller than what President Trump announced earlier this week.
Acting Director Mark Morgan says ICE plans to arrest and deport thousands of migrant family members who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border in recent months and have already received final orders of removal from a judge.
If you're here illegally, then you should be removed. And in this case, that includes families.
Morgan would not say when the operation will begin or how many migrants are targeted, but he did say they include migrant families whose immigration cases were sped up under a special Justice Department program launched last year. That suggests the total will be in the thousands, not millions, as President Trump tweeted on Monday. Morgan says the goal is to discourage Central American migrants from fleeing to the U.S. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Russia's foreign ministry is disputing the charges against Russian nationals in the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 5 years ago that killed all 298 people on board. Three former Russian military officials and one Ukrainian are the first suspects to face criminal charges for the downing of the jet over Ukraine in 2014. As Terry Schultz tells us, investigators say evidence proves all four had connections to Moscow.
The Dutch-led international investigative team says this is just the start of its prosecutions. The Dutch public prosecutor says they have enough evidence to go forward with cases against Igor Girkin, Sergei Dubinsky, Oleg Pulatov, and Leonid Karshenko, whom they say all were involved in the separatist movement in eastern Ukraine, where the decision was allegedly made to fire the Russian-made Buk missile at the plane.
That's Terry Schultz reporting. Stocks finished higher on Wall Street, led by financial companies and banks. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. The Boston City Council is considering a new Trust Act. That's the ordinance governing how Boston police interact with federal immigration authorities. The amended version was introduced today at City Hall, and WBUR's Shannon Dooling has this report.
City Councilor Josh Zakim says now is the time to make these changes to the Trust Act, given President Trump's aggressive action on immigration. Zakim says the new amendments further clarify the role of Boston Police in cooperating with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
The Boston Police Department or other city agencies are not going to actively work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to detain people, to investigate them, to share information around immigration issues.
City Councilor Lydia Edwards expressed her strong support for a strengthened Trust Act. The ordinance will now be considered in a subcommittee. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Cities and towns in Massachusetts trying to prepare for the effects of climate change now have access to more state funding. Baker administration's awarding $12 million in grants to 99 communities working to either identify vulnerabilities or start resiliency projects. State's Department of Energy and Environmental Affairs says this is the largest release of climate resiliency funding in state history. The longtime girlfriend of the late South Boston mob boss James Whitey Bulger is now in a halfway house in Massachusetts. Catherine Gregg will serve out the rest of her prison sentence there. In 2012, she was sentenced to 8 years in prison for helping Bulger evade capture. The Boston Red Sox say they do not plan to extend the protective netting at Fenway Park this season. So far this year, two fans at different major league games have been injured by balls hit into the stands beyond the dugout. Yesterday, the Chicago White Sox became the first team in Major League Baseball to say they would extend netting from foul pole to foul pole. The time is 5:34.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's Metropolitan College, offering online undergraduate degree completion in interdisciplinary studies. Build off previously completed college credits and earn your bachelor's degree in as few as 30 months. Learn more at an informational webinar Tuesday, July 16th at 1 p.m. Sign up at bu.edu/met/info.
In sports, Red Sox will play the rubber match of a three-game set with the Twins in Minnesota tonight. Eduardo Rodriguez on the mound. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight. Chance of a shower late. Lows around 60 degrees. More clouds tomorrow. Showers and rain later in the day and overnight. Highs around 70. Right now, 72 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Believing in the power of scientists to make basic science discoveries that change the world, learn more at hhmi.org. And Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The vast majority of migrants coming to the U.S.-Mexico border are from Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. But along with them are hundreds of Africans. Many of them are seeking asylum after seeing others recently gain entry to the U.S. We're going to follow some of these African migrants who have just arrived in the U.S. We start with Bonnie Petrie of Texas Public Radio and her report from San Antonio.
Once these migrants cross the border, they pile into white vans. The shuttles drop the traveling families off on a busy street corner in downtown San Antonio, outside the city's Migrant Service Center. When migrants started arriving at the center from places like the Congos and Angola, it didn't take city workers long to figure out they needed translators.
So we're down here working with the city right now at their relief center, helping purchase bus tickets, and we brought down a lot of staff who either speak Swahili or French to help with language needs.
Peter Stranges works for Catholic Charities in San Antonio. Usually, he's more of a desk guy, a vice president who rarely interacts with the immigrants they serve. But he also speaks French. So he's outside the city's Migrant Service Center talking to a cluster of serious young men and a woman with a sleeping baby strapped to her back.
So they're getting here. A lot of them don't even know what city they're in when they arrive. They're also hungry and they're tired and they're thirsty. So we're just helping them reach out and get in contact with sponsors who may be able to help them on the other end of their journeys.
My name is Michelle. I'm from Congo. I'm here in Texas, San Antonio.
Michelle was one of the few migrants who did speak English. He didn't give us his last name. He and his wife and three children are from Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Michelle says they had to leave.
Because in Congo, the life is not good. The political situation is not good. And he came here. I think here I have a good life.
Michelle and his family fled political strife and civil unrest in the DRC. In January, they flew to South America and started trekking north, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border in the Del Rio sector of Texas. Border Patrol agents in that sector recently took more than 500 African migrants into custody in just 1 week.
I think
the migrant crisis at the U.S. border has been so well publicized, and because of all of the chaos over policymaking in Washington, D.C., it all gives the appearance that the U.S. border is really open for business right now.
Randy Capps is a researcher at the Migration Policy Institute. He says Central African migrants are also drawn to the U.S. because Europe is not so open for business and because the boat trip across the Mediterranean can be treacherous. In fact, Capps says, many Central Africans don't even make it to the sea. They're at refugee camps in North Africa.
Many of them are stuck and languishing in really poor conditions, some in near slave conditions in Libya right now. So, you know, when conditions at home are desperate and the Europe option doesn't look good, the sort of high-priced long-distance option to try to come to the U.S. might be worth it.
First, they fly to South America, and when they get there, they find well-traveled roads to follow north.
That journey through Central America and Mexico has been facilitated by these large migrant caravans, by more sophisticated and faster smuggling routes, and it's an easier journey from, say, Guatemala onward than it has been in the past.
Capps says you can expect more migrants from all over the world to seek asylum here unless Mexico does more to stop them. President Trump has given Mexico 45 days to act.
Merci, pareillement. Thank you.
Merci. For NPR News, I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
After arriving in border towns like San Antonio, many of these asylum seekers continue their journeys north. For some, it's much farther north. Portland, Maine is more than 2,000 miles from the southern border. There, the newcomers join large communities of African immigrants, and Portland provides aid to asylum seekers, though the recent arrivals are taxing social services. Robbie Feinberg of Maine Public Radio takes us there.
At a recent press conference, Portland Mayor Ethan Strimling called this current wave of families seeking asylum our future. The state is grappling with an aging population.
We need to do everything we can to make sure that when they arrive, they are stable and that they as quickly as possible are able to get on their feet and start supporting their families and contributing to our economy.
But the influx has stressed the city, which didn't have enough room in shelters to house the many newcomers who arrived last week. So it was forced to convert a minor league sports arena into a makeshift emergency shelter for more than 200 asylum seekers. Inside, cots line the floor next to rows of tables and chairs. Volunteers offer food and health supplies. Some translate and build arts and crafts projects with the young children running across the floors.
I need like 6 pieces of paper. Huh? Mucho paper.
Uh-huh. We have a whole sack.
Two asylum seekers named Philippe and Mireille sit with their four young children near several cots they pushed together to create a space for their family. They didn't want their last names used to protect their privacy. The family says they arrived in Portland after a nearly 5-month journey from their home in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Through a translator, Mireille says the family was forced to flee violent militias and civil unrest. They flew to Ecuador, then walked across Central America to reach the United States.
We spent 5 days with no food for the children at all. All the food we had brought was finished.
Philippe says they pushed themselves to keep going, drinking sips of juice to maintain their energy. They'd carry the children on their back, he says, traverse rivers, and walk along teetering paths through the mountains of Panama.
I can't advise anyone to come.
Moi, j'ai pris la grâce à l'éternel Dieu.
I just thank the eternal God for the grace to get me here.
When they finally reached the U.S.-Mexico border, Philippe says they waited in lines for more than 2 months to finally cross. After the months of walking, the waiting, and a bus ride from San Antonio, they arrived in Portland last week. And despite his uncertain future, Philippe describes his situation at the emergency shelter as paradise. He hopes to work as a driver here, like he did in his home country.
I was thinking, what could I do to, you know, what could I wish for in life, and this is what I wish for. I really thank you so much.
Immigrant communities and advocacy groups have worked with the city to volunteer and get supplies to the newcomers, everything from diapers to snacks. And donations have poured into a city-run fundraiser, $350,000 so far. But Portland City Councilor Justin Costa told Governor Janet Mills at a public meeting last week that the city still faces a long-term challenge of how to house and aid these migrant families in the months ahead.
We don't operate that number of beds. We don't operate that number of facilities to be able to accommodate this. So I think that that's the next step that we are going to need to address.
Mills told city leaders that the state hopes to help out. She said that these migrants have endured brutality and bloodshed, and the people of Maine have a proud tradition of caring for their neighbors. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Feinberg in Portland, Maine.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The U.S. women's soccer team is back in action tomorrow at the Women's World Cup in France. The team is taking on its biggest opponent yet, Sweden, a key match for the U.S., and there's plenty else going on at the tournament. Here to catch us up is NPR's Laurel Wamsley. She's been following the U.S. team in France, and she joins us on the line from there now. Hey there.
Hi there.
Hi. So I want to get to the U.S. women in just a second, but I gather it's a player from Brazil who's got everybody buzzing today.
Absolutely. That's Marta. She's the Brazilian superstar. You've probably heard about her. And she scored on a penalty last night in their game, in Brazil's game against Italy. And with that goal, she set the all-time scoring record for most World Cup goals, men or women, with 14. And in a press conference after the match, Marta talked about how she's dedicating that goal to all the girls who believe in their dreams. And she said that the Brazilian team can be an example in their country and also to South America that women can do every kind of role. But she also pointed out that given the huge audience for this event, that in a way, each team is doing that in their own home country. And because of Marta's goal, Brazil will now go through to the knockout round, which had been in question.
Okay. All right. So the U.S. team, we said they take on Sweden. That's going to be tomorrow. What are the stakes here?
Well, this is a matchup with a lot of history. So the U.S. used to have a Swedish coach, Pia Sundhage, and she led them to Olympic golds in both 2008 and 2012. And then right after the 2012 Olympics, she left the U.S. squad and went to coach Sweden. And then in the 2016 Olympics, Sundhage was the coach of Sweden that knocked out the U.S. team in the quarterfinals. And no U.S. women's soccer team had ever left a major tournament that early, so it was a huge blow. And it's been said that the coach who took over after Sundhage, Jill Ellis, who's the coach now, has spent a lot of time watching the tape and spending time with that and figuring out how does this U.S. team face off against teams like Sweden that just bunker down defensively and won't let them through.
Wow. So quite a rivalry, and it sounds like quite a game potentially tomorrow. This is not going to be like the opening match where we saw the U.S. just dominate against Thailand. Was it 13-0, I think?
Yes, it was. And no, this will be nothing like that. So people are predicting maybe 2-0, 2-1 against Sweden. This is going to be the first real test for the U.S. at this tournament, especially for the defense and for new goalkeeper Alyssa Nayer. They just haven't had much come their way so far. Here's what Coach Jill Ellis said earlier today about this game.
This is going to be great for us because we do need to sharpen that in terms of, you know, the first two games, we haven't had a lot of balls to deal with in behind, and Alyssa hasn't had a lot to deal with. But, you know, I'd also sort of remind the players that we've played one of the most competitive schedules, and for that very purpose, to have as many of those moments before we came to this big stage.
And so the thing about this game is that both the U.S. and Sweden are already through. And if the U.S. were to lose to Sweden tomorrow, they would actually maybe have an easier path in this tournament because they may have to play France if they win in the quarterfinals. But that's just not how this team plays. This team plays to win, and that's what they're going to go out there to tomorrow.
Yeah. And before I let you go, just a quick sense of the scene, because you've been all over. You've been in Paris. You've been in France. Where are you exactly today?
Right now, I'm in Le Havre, a couple miles from where the team is going to play tomorrow.
And is everybody totally caught up in this?
Yes and no. In Paris, you almost wouldn't know what's happening. There's almost no signage, no indication that it's happening. You still see more signs for the men's football games than the women's. But here in these smaller towns where the U.S. has been playing, in France and in Le Havre, you do see them a lot more. And there is a palpable excitement here. And of course, wherever the U.S. plays, the U.S. fans go. So there's a lot of excitement.
All righty. Thank you, Laurel.
Thank you.
NPR's Laurel Wormsley reporting, and this is NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by The Door Store in Cambridge, now featuring one-of-a-kind live-edge slab tables. More about customizable tables, shelving, and accessories at doorstorecambridge.com. Mass College of Art and Design on Boston's Avenue of the Arts, offering campus tours all summer. massart.edu/discover. And Peabody Essex Museum. See outstanding examples of American painting, furniture, and decorative arts from the collection of Carolyn and Peter Lynch, now on view. PEM.org.
This is WBUR. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight. Chance of a shower late with lows around 60 degrees. Right now, 72 degrees in Boston at 549.
WBUR supporters include Jay Miles, a neighborhood boutique in Huron Village serving a community of women interested in a personalized approach to shopping. Jay Miles, distinctive dressing for discerning women. Sunbug Solar, a certified B Corporation offering full-service solar system design and installation. Learn what the sun can do for you at sunbugsolar.com. And Out to Lunch. Enjoy live music, food trucks, and local vendors on the Worcester Common each Thursday all summer long. From the Worcester Cultural Coalition at worcesterculture.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. This week is Member Appreciation Week here at WBUR, which means it's time for us to take a moment to say thank you. I do, on average, 8 or 10 interviews every single day on all different topics, and it's a team of people at Here and Now that brings all the important information and research to those interviews so that we can make sure that we get our facts right, that we're fair, and that we're keeping it interesting. So thank you for helping us bring these stories to you and everyone in the community.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Today is Juneteenth, a day commemorating the emancipation of enslaved African Americans. The day has special meaning in Africatown, a small community in Mobile, Alabama, founded by African captives brought on the last slave ship to the United States. Residents say the recent discovery of the remains of that ship, the Clotilde, is reviving interest in preserving their heritage. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Lorna Wood's great-great-grandfather, Charlie Lewis, was brought to Mobile on the Clotilde, thought to have arrived sometime around 1859 or 1860. Now, she tells his story as a volunteer with a local history museum.
I tell people they didn't come here as free men. They came in chains.
Standing on the downtown corner that was once the city's slave market, Woods holds up the rusty shackles she found under an old box spring in her grandmother's house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Woods says for a long time, mostly out of fear, her ancestors kept the story of the Clotilde closely guarded. She learned about it sitting on her grandmother's front porch in Africatown, a community just north of downtown, settled by the West Africans smuggled here on the Clotilde.
And they built that little town from just about nothing, just from the bushes and the trees they cut down. They made a place where they could carry on their history from Africa, and their children would be able to see that they wasn't lazy, they wasn't good for nothing, but they had a lot of pride.
Interest in Africatown has been on the rise since Clotilde's survivor Cudjoe Lewis's story was the subject of last year's bestseller Barracoon by Zora Neale Hurston, published after her death. And the discovery last month of the shipwreck in the Mobile River is bringing new attention.
Well, good morning. My name's Eric Finley. I'm going to be your docent today.
Eric Finley leads tours for the Dora Franklin Finley African American Heritage Trail in Mobile. He drives a van along the riverfront where the schooner, the Clotilde, smuggled enslaved Africans more than 50 years after the U.S. had outlawed the slave trade.
It was the result of a rich white plantation owner in this area that we're going to, and he made a bet with another rich white plantation owner that he could bring in 100 illegal individuals.
The story goes the plantation owner, a wealthy shipbuilder and businessman named Timothy Mayer, hired a captain to make the trip to what is now the country of Benin, Africa. Back in U.S. waters, the slaves were hidden in inland swamps. The Clotilde was scuttled upriver and set afire to hide any evidence. Federal prosecutors opened an investigation, but never brought the case to trial with the impending civil war.
It is a very difficult story.
Joycelyn Davis is a sixth-generation Clotilda descendant.
My family was brought over illegally on a bet, naked.
Davis said she heard stories about the Clotilda growing up in Africatown, but didn't really embrace it.
Honestly, I was a little ashamed about the story.
Partly because what she was told about the role of Africans in the slave trade.
There was a dispute between two tribes, our own people, and they sold us. You know, that's the shame that I had.
Now Davis is working to preserve the history here, but says there are obstacles. Africatown is surrounded by a paper mill, chemical plants, and oil storage tanks. It's bordered on three sides by water, including the Mobile River. Residents have filed a lawsuit over industrial pollution. Joycelyn Davis crosses the major highway that now cuts through the middle of Africatown to a sloping hillside where sprawling oak trees shade gray stone grave markers.
The old cemetery faces east because one thing that Cudjo and the other survivors of the Clotilda, they all wanted to go back home to Africa, so the cemetery faces east towards Africa.
Davis says after emancipation, Timothy Mayer would not provide his former slaves passage back to Africa. They continued to work on plantations and at his paper mill to earn money to buy the land that became Africatown. Mayer's descendants still own the surrounding property, and there's a Mayer State Park named for the family on Mobile Bay.
Everything around here belongs to them. You know, so they have been ever present all of my life.
Descendants of Timothy Mayer declined to speak about the discovery of the Clotilda. Davis and other descendants of the enslaved Africans say they'd like to meet with the Mayer family to hear their side of history.
I'm Darren Patterson. I'm a Clotilda descendant. Polly Yellen was my great-great-grandfather.
Who helped found Africatown. In his 60s now, Patterson has seen the community struggle since he was a child.
It's not what it used to be. When I was small and growing up, it was a community that was self-contained. We had stores and barbershops and post offices, you know, and gas stations and drug stores. And over the years, like many other communities, it's seen a share of downtimes.
The commerce is gone now, and you see boarded up homes and vacant lots in the neighborhood. The population has declined from about 12,000 in the 1960s to less than 2,000 today. In 2012, Africatown was listed on the National Register of Historic Places, but little came of the designation. Now, Patterson is hopeful the blight and neglect will end with the discovery of the ship.
The pride now that is being regenerated by what's happened with the Clotilda is amazing.
There's talk of redeveloping the town and opening a museum to house a replica of the Clotilda. The state has allocated $3.5 million from its BP oil spill settlement to build an Africatown Welcome Center. The old one was washed away by Hurricane Katrina in 2005, and the property is overrun with weeds and litter. And the National Park Service is planning a waterfront park in the community. But Patterson says revitalization isn't enough.
What justice now? If there was a lack of evidence against Timothy Mayer then, and this boat actually turns out to be the evidence that there were slaves brought here illegally, what do we do now? There's got to be something that happens.
Mobile attorney and city judge Carlos Finley says descendants may have a case for reparations.
What the ship does is it takes this story out of the realm of lore. You see, prior to the ship being discovered, there were people who could argue that, oh, that's just old wives' tales. That didn't really happen.
The shipwreck remains in the murky waters of the Mobile River, under guard now, an irreplaceable cultural treasure, according to the Alabama Historical Commission. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Mobile.
With all the news happening every day, it can be hard to keep up. You can check out our podcast up first, though. You'll get the day's biggest stories in about 10 minutes. It's available every weekday morning, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from MD Anderson Cancer Center, where physicians treat all types of cancers with a team of nearly 21,000, all devoted to ending cancer and providing hope to patients. More at MakingCancerHistory.com. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, marking 30 years of tracking child well-being nationally and state by state with the Kids Count Data Book and Data Center. Learn more at datacenter.kidscount.org. And Total Wine and More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR, online at WBUR.org. Coming up next hour on All Things Considered, the UN reports nearly 71 million people were displaced in the last year, the largest number since World War II. We'll get that and more in the next hour here on WBUR. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight, chance of a shower late with lows around 60 degrees. More clouds tomorrow with possible showers and rain later in the day and overnight, highs around 70 degrees. Friday, showers in the morning, maybe a downpour, then clouds the rest of the day, highs in the mid-70s. Right now, 73 degrees in Boston at 5:59.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
President Trump promises to deport millions of people in the country illegally as the left and right debate whether facilities holding migrants qualify as concentration camps. It's Wednesday, June 19th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good evening, I'm Jack Lepiars. Coming up, the former acting director of Immigrations and Customs Enforcement weighs in on the pledge as the current acting director issues another warning to migrants today.
Not only will we be enforcing the law, but we're also going to send a powerful message to individuals in the Northern Triangle country. Do not come. Do not risk it.
Also this hour, the White House rolls back another Obama-era environmental protection, something that would allow coal plants to stay open longer. And at 6:30 on Marketplace, recapping the Federal Reserve's June meetings. It's 6:01. First, this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The Trump administration's point person on Iran is traveling this week to the Middle East and Europe to talk about the threats that country poses. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Brian Hook is also trying to reassure lawmakers the goal is to restore deterrence and not provoke conflict.
Democrats on the House Foreign Affairs Committee are raising concerns that the U.S. and Iran could stumble into war. Special Representative Brian Hook is telling them the goal is to get back to negotiations.
No one should be uncertain about our desire for peace or our readiness to normalize relations should we reach a comprehensive deal.
The Trump administration pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, reimposing sanctions and beefing up the U.S. military presence in the region to put pressure on Iran. Hook will be briefing officials in Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states before stopping in Paris to meet British, German and French diplomats. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has moved a step closer to winding back the clock in terms of the use of coal-fired power plants through a repeal of the Obama-era Clean Power Plan. Environmental Protection Agency Chief Andrew Wheeler, speaking to reporters after signing a final version of the repeal, says it will lead investors to put more money into coal plants. U.S. coal plant closings have reached near record numbers in recent years, owing to competition from cheaper natural gas and renewable energy. The Senate has voted 52-46 to confirm a controversial federal judge. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports the nominee has been opposed by civil rights and LGBTQ groups.
President Trump first nominated Matthew Kaczmarek for a seat on the district court in the Northern District of Texas in 2017. Kaczmarek quickly drew criticism for his writings on LGBTQ issues. He opposed the Supreme Court ruling that legalized same-sex marriage, and civil rights groups argue he's hostile to gay rights and women's rights. LGBTQ advocates say they're especially upset the Senate scheduled his confirmation vote during Pride Month. Early in his career, Kaczmarek worked on national security issues at the Justice Department. More recently, he's focused on religious freedom cases. The judge post carries a lifetime appointment. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The Federal Reserve wrapped up a two-day meeting in Washington, leaving interest rates unchanged. Fed Chair Jerome Powell telling reporters the central bank will act as appropriate to sustain the economic expansion as it approaches the 10-year mark.
The risks that we see having emerged are risks that have gotten our attention and that have called a number of us to write down rate cuts and a number of those who haven't to see that the case has strengthened.
Policymakers also dropping the word patient from an end-of-meeting statement indicating a rate cut could be on the horizon. The Dow was up today 38 points. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jack Lepiarz in Boston. At this hour, a news conference in the Dominican Republic on the shooting of Red Sox star David Ortiz is just getting underway. Prosecutors had been expected to release preliminary results of their investigation into the June 9th attack in a Santo Domingo bar. Ortiz, meantime, is in good condition at Mass General Hospital in Boston. A key piece of evidence in the Kevin Spacey criminal case on Nantucket is missing. Today, the lawyer for the man accusing the actor of groping him at a bar claims he cannot find the cell phone he's been ordered to turn over to the defense. A Nantucket District Court judge ordered the device to be handed over by Friday. Spacey's lawyers want to try to recover text messages that they say would help his case. The judge is now extending that deadline until July 8th. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark is supporting the creation of a commission to consider compensation for the descendants of slaves. Clark, a member of the House leadership team, says a commission needs to investigate the stigma and stain of slavery.
To look at the history and to examine what happened and how it is continuing to have a true impact on African Americans and our country in general.
Clark's accusing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of ignoring the impact and legacy of the country's history. McConnell is opposed to reparations. State Police, Everett Police, and the head of the Encore Boston Harbor Casino are discussing the public transportation options for Sunday's opening of the resort. Everett Mayor Carlo Di Maria says since people can use water taxis and shuttle buses from the Orange Line, he sees no reason to drive to the area.
I'm confident that we have the resources we need in place. I think we're all one voice when we tell visitors to please leave your cars at home.
Parking in local neighborhoods will be prohibited. In sports, Red Sox play the rubber match of a three-game set with the Twins in Minnesota. Forecast is cloudy skies overnight tonight. Chance of a shower. Lows around 60 degrees. Right now, 73 degrees in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by LaSalle Village in Newton. Engaging retirement living on the LaSalle College campus. Call now for available one-bedroom units. LaSalleVillage.org. And the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Guided by the belief that the arts and humanities are essential to the well-being of diverse and democratic societies. Learn more at mellon.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump is promising to deport millions of people in the U.S. illegally starting next week. Today, his acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement gave some details.
Not only will we be enforcing the law, maintaining the integrity of the system, but we're also going to send a powerful message to the individuals in the Northern Triangle country, do not come, do not risk it, because once you get here, once you receive due process and get a final order, you will be removed.
That's Mark Morgan speaking with reporters today. He suggested that thousands of people will be deported, not millions, as the president said. He said first up will be migrant families and others who have received final orders of removal. To talk about what this entails, we're joined now by John Sandweg. He served as acting director of ICE under the Obama administration. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So Morgan says these are people who have had due process, who ICE now has no choice but to deport. How much of a shift would this actually be from what this government has been doing?
Well, historically, other than a brief period of time during the Obama administration, the truth is that there has not been much in the way of enforcement efforts against individuals who came to this country, filed an asylum claim, lost, and were not detained during the process. candidly, I think that when I was at ICE and during my time at DHS, we just thought that there were higher priority individuals, folks who posed a threat to public safety, you know, that we should dedicate our resources to rather than focus necessarily on this population.
Well, what do you think of this policy?
Well, listen, I do think it's important that we have integrity in our asylum system. And I think the important part that the acting director said is that whether you get a full and fair process. The problem here, though, unfortunately, is that there's a lot of chaos in the system right now. Everybody's dramatically overwhelmed. And there's a very high likelihood that a lot of these people who have a so-called final order of removal never even knew they had a hearing before an immigration judge.
You say that everybody in this process is totally overwhelmed. Setting aside whether it's a good idea or not, is it something that can be implemented? Is there capacity to do this?
It's going to be hard. And look, the question here is, what's going to give? ICE only has so many resources, and I think the Trump administration likes to act like they're pushing ICE, you know, in ways whereas the Obama administration was not. But the reality here is that ICE has always operated at 100% of its capacity. So the question is, when you look at who is ICE focusing its enforcement efforts on, as it now takes on this additional responsibility, who are they going to diminish their enforcement efforts against? And I guess my biggest concern would be, are we going to see a diminishment in the focus on individuals with serious criminal histories or coming out of federal prisons or state prisons who actually pose a threat to public safety in order to focus on this population?
So is the crunch with the actual ICE agents who would be finding people and putting them into deportation proceedings, where is the crunch?
Yeah, the entire system. The number of ICE agents who are going to go find these individuals, it's very labor-intensive work to find these individuals. So now when you're out there doing that work, maybe you're not being able to respond to a jail or a prison where there's a serious, you know, violent felony offender being booked. It's also going to be the crunch, though, with the, you know, just in terms of the charter flight network and the detention beds. ICE is already at 52,000 beds. They're only budgeted for 40. So they're already stretching their budget very thin in terms of detention. This is something that has to be done very carefully. When you're talking about a lot of these are going to be family units with minor children. Now, fortunately, unlike the family separation, they will keep the family unit together. But there's no way to do this without some detention of including vulnerable minor children. And that is incredibly sensitive. And what concerns me is, have there been adequate plans put in place to ensure that this is done as carefully as possible?
What do you make of the discrepancy between the acting ICE director, Mark Morgan, implying that thousands of people are going to be deported and the president saying it will be millions?
I think the acting director's, you know, prediction of thousands of deportations is much more likely than millions. In the most vigorous year of enforcement in ICE history, ICE only removed 400,000 people. It'll be very difficult for ICE to remove anywhere near that level of individuals, no matter how hard the president pushes them.
That's John Sandwig. He served as acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement under President Obama. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The United Nations says every minute of last year, 25 people were forced to flee their homes somewhere in the world. That adds up to a total of nearly 71 million people now forcibly displaced. It's the highest number since the Second World War. Two countries in particular have seen a huge number of newly displaced people. They are Venezuela and Ethiopia. To tell us more, we're joined by NPR's Eder Peralta. He is just south of Ethiopia in Nairobi, Kenya. Hi, Eder.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hey, so who are these people who make up this really staggering statistic, 71 million people?
So the number refers to the people who are displaced. So that means refugees, but also people who have been forced to leave their homes but are living inside their own country. Mm-hmm. The UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, says that in 2018, almost 14 million people were displaced. And as you said, that is the largest number of displaced people since World War II. I was talking to UNHCR's Chana Gedeni-Williams, and she says she started working at the Refugee Agency 20 years ago. And she says since she started, that number has doubled. And that is in part because of the nature of displacement. It's changed. Let's listen to a bit of what she told me.
At least when I started, like with the Bosnian War, the majority of people went back. Same thing with Rwanda. Like we had millions of people going back home. But now what we see is the Syrias, the South Sudans, they're all staying for decades.
Essentially, what Gedeni-Williams is saying is that the world is failing to find solutions to displacement crises, so the total number just keeps going up.
Yeah. Let's talk about the countries they are coming from. I mentioned Venezuela, which, while sad, I guess is not so surprising given the political and economic chaos there of late. But what about Ethiopia? What is the story there?
I mean, it's actually the opposite of Venezuela, because last year, Ethiopia emerged from a prolonged political crisis. And Ethiopians, they now have a prime minister they like, and a prime minister who has declared peace with Eritrea, which is their historic rival. But what's also happened is that the popular rebellion that brought Abiy Ahmed to power also left the federal and regional governments weakened. And all of these ethnic conflicts that had been simmering for decades, all of them are coming to a head. So there's just been a lot of intercommunal fighting in Ethiopia, and it's been spread across a huge part of this massive populous country.
What does this report have to say about where these people are going to? What countries they're going to? How those countries are coping?
I mean, I think stateside, you guys hear a lot about the record number of people crossing the southern border, your southern border, and seeking asylum. But the fact is that developed countries are not bearing the brunt of this displacement crisis. And that's because the vast majority of people, 4 out of 5 who flee their country, go to a neighboring one. So in my patch, for example, it's Uganda, which is one of the poorest countries in the world, who has taken in more than 1 million South Sudanese refugees. Turkey is hosting 3.6 million Syrian refugees. And the only big Western country among the top 10 is Germany, which has taken about 1 million refugees.
That's NPR's Eder Peralta. He is in Nairobi. Thanks, Eder.
Thank you.
Today, the Trump administration threw its biggest lifeline yet to the ailing coal industry. It's a new rule called Affordable Clean Energy, and it replaces one of President Obama's signature efforts to address climate change. NPR's Jeff Brady joins us now with details. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ari.
So what's the difference between President Trump's Affordable Clean Energy, or ACE as they are calling it, and Obama's Clean Power Plan?
Well, the Obama rule, the Clean Power Plan, it was more sweeping and more specific. It directed states to reduce emissions from power plants by nearly a third by year 2030. It let states figure out how to do that. But for many of them, that would have meant shutting down coal-fired power plants because they emit more greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide, which, of course, contribute to climate change. The ACE rule is more narrowly focused and gives states more discretion. This rule looks at individual power plants and what can be done to make them more efficient. That means under the Trump administration rule, it's more likely that a coal plant currently operating could stay open longer.
The Obama administration's Clean Power Plan actually never took effect because 24 states, many of them coal-producing states, sued to block it. How are people in those states and the coal industry responding today?
Well, they're very happy about this rule change. They thought the Obama administration overstepped its authority under the Clean Air Act with its plan. At the EPA headquarters today, there were some coal workers in their gear and hard hats for the announcement. At one point, they were given a standing ovation. And among the speakers was Michelle Bloodworth. She's head of the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. She said this new rule will prevent more coal power plants from shutting down or retiring, as the industry calls it.
Avoiding additional retirements is so important given that 40% of the coal fleet has either retired or announced retirement, and we expect under the Clean Power Plan there certainly would have been a lot more.
Of course, President Trump campaigned saying that he would help the coal industry, but dozens of plants have shut down since he was elected, mostly because natural gas and renewable energy are cheaper.
And what are environmental groups saying about the new rule today?
They're very critical of this rule. Climate change is on a lot of people's minds now, and they think the country should be doing more to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, not less. Joining the criticism are former Obama administration officials who were involved in writing the Clean Power Plan. Janet McCabe was at the EPA back then.
I think what this rule cements in people's minds is that this administration has no intent of doing anything meaningful to address climate change, which is affecting people and communities across the country now, and that will increase.
Environmental groups and others have already said they plan to sue to challenge this plan. A key question will be how far can the EPA go in setting national policy on carbon emissions? Because there's a sense that this rule change from the Trump administration could make it more difficult for future administrations to take an aggressive approach.
The whole purpose of the Clean Power Plan was to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. How is the country doing on that front?
You know, not bad, actually. The country has almost reached the Clean Power Plan goal a decade early. But the reasons have very little to do with policy. It's more a function of markets favoring natural gas and renewable energy. I've talked with plant owners who say they can shut down a coal plant, build a couple gas plants, produce a lot more electricity, and still have room left over to put some solar panels in an industrial park, because they don't have to have all that room to store coal and coal ash after it's burned. So the economics just don't favor coal power plants right now. Still, scientists say that to avoid the worst effects of climate change, we need to reduce emissions a lot more, basically down to nothing within about 3 decades. And many experts say it's difficult to see how that could happen without aggressive federal policies.
That's NPR's Jeff Brady. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Peter of Larry's Tackle Shop on Martha's Vineyard. WBUR is on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM and always on the WBUR Listen app.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by BU School of Social Work, offering a top-ranked Master of Social Work degree program, a fully funded doctoral program, and professional education programs that take your social work career to the next level. Become a change maker and visit bu.edu/SSW.
This is WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, how popular restaurants change their neighborhoods, a study of gentrification in LA's Chinatown. In business news, voters in North Andover are giving the go-ahead to zoning changes that could allow for a massive Amazon distribution center to open in town. Amazon's announced plans to build a 3.6 million square foot facility that would eventually employ up to 1,500 workers. Amazon expects it to take until 2022 before operations at the site get underway. More business news coming up on Marketplace at 6:30. Right now, the time is 6:19.
Funding for WBUR's business report comes from Vertex, a proud contributor of Massachusetts' innovation ecosystem. Fueled by the needs of patients, families, doctors, and nurses, Vertex invests in science to develop new medicines and strike at the core of serious diseases. Learn more at VRTX.com.
In the forecast, clouds and rain the next couple of days. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
It's muggy out there this evening, and that will continue through the overnight hours, actually right into Friday. Temperatures tonight fall toward 60 by morning. Can't rule out a stray shower. Tomorrow, a couple of showers around. Best chance for those will be in the afternoon. Temperature near 70, but it's going to feel very humid. A few downpours Thursday night, even the rumble of thunder. Then on Friday, mid-70s, any of the showers come to an end. Late day clearing. It also turns drier Friday night, and that will set us up for a glorious weekend. Mid to upper 70s Saturday with sunshine. Near 80 on Sunday with sunshine, slightly cooler Cape and the Islands.
Right now, 73 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
WBUR supporters include Lexus, introducing a new model, the Lexus UX, a luxury subcompact SUV available as a hybrid with all-wheel drive, now available at your local Lexus dealer. And Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, providing advanced care and innovative research. Spalding has been named the number 2 rehabilitation hospital in the country by U.S. News & World Report.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That holy grail of New York housing, rent control, could be spreading beyond New York City. New York State has signed sweeping new rent laws that would extend protections throughout the state. Cities such as Buffalo and Rochester can opt into the new rules, helping protect their renters. Landlords call it a dangerous precedent that will shrink the market of affordable housing. Charles Lane of member station WSHU reports.
The Upper West Side fairy tale of a rent-controlled apartment could be moving north to Newburgh.
There's people living in Bedbug City. There's people that's living in mold. There's people that's being locked out. There's people being evicted.
Carla Johnson is showing off all the places she's been evicted from in Newburgh, former industrial town on the Hudson River, 2 hours north of Manhattan. She says most apartment owners in Newburgh do the bare minimum to maintain a unit. If tenants complain, they get evicted.
It's cheaper for the landlord to put you out and move someone else in that doesn't know about the problem.
But new tenant protections may be on the way for cities that embrace the new rules. After Democrats took control of the state Senate, they were able to tweak and expand a law that only applied to New York City. They closed a number of loopholes, allowing landlords to deregulate apartments. But renters outside the city want their officials to adopt these new protections, too. Juanita Lewis is an organizer for the group Community Voices Heard. She's excited to see these new rules possibly spread to other cities in New York State.
There's the, you know, right to make sure repairs are done, or at least being able to have some comfort in making a complaint to, like, buildings and codes and not feeling like you're about to be retaliated against. The rent increases wouldn't be as much, whereas right now, Newburgh doesn't have any of those things.
Alex Russo follows rent laws around the country for the National Apartment Association, which represents landlords. He says New York now joins Oregon in trying to solve a housing affordability issue.
The trend is spreading to not just the coasts, but more and more states. I mean, Colorado had a bill introduced this session. I would predict that Washington will be the next place where you will see this type of policy introduced.
Russo and many economists argue that these type of laws do the opposite of what proponents want, actually making housing less affordable by reducing the supply. In Newburgh, some landlords have an immediate response to the new laws.
It's time to go. It's time to go. How am I going to survive?
Michael Acevedo heads the Orange County Landlord Association. He blames tenants, not landlords, for the poor living conditions.
The tenants kept wrecking it. I kept going in and fixing it. Finally, the mortgage and the taxes were more money than I could rent it for.
Studies suggest that closing the loopholes and protecting pricey $3,000 a month apartments only helps wealthy renters. They show overall rent laws tend to shrink the number of regulated apartments as landlords find new loopholes to deregulate them.
I mean, you know, you go into business to make money, right? I don't do it for my health. I do it to pay my bills and send my kids to college, you know, whatever.
Even though much of the research shows that rent control doesn't help most tenants in the long run, advocates say at least current tenants are protected. As tenant advocates work to spread these new protections across the state, a coalition of landlord groups will likely lobby cities not to adopt the new rules. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane.
In L.A.'s Chinatown neighborhood, Howlin' Ray's is one of the hottest restaurants, and not just because Chef Johnny Raisone serves up super spicy Nashville hot chicken. Day after day, Howlin' Ray's has a line that stretches around the block.
We heard from someone in the front it's going to be about a 90-minute wait.
Twitter said like an hour and a half.
Have I been to Chinatown before for anything else? Probably not. I think I've only been here for Howlin' Ray's.
So good. This is a religious experience.
Those were Eric Aguado, Micah Smith, Victor Aguado, and Natalie Skeegan, some of the people waiting in line outside the restaurant on a recent weekday.
A lot of the hype around the restaurant comes from social media. Howlin' Ray's Instagram account has more than 150,000 followers. YouTubers post videos of themselves sweating and crying through boxes of Howlin' Ray's hottest chicken. Frank Shong is an LA Times columnist who wrote about how restaurants like Howlin' Ray's are reshaping Chinatown. It's part of a larger conversation about gentrification and what booming urban neighborhoods mean for the people who've lived there for decades. The headline of his recent column, "Many in Chinatown have never tried its most popular restaurant, so I brought the food to them."
Howlin' Ray's is located in Far East Plaza, which is this kind of double-decker interior type of strip mall. And that plaza has seen a lot of new restaurants in the last couple of years and become kind of this foodie destination that people all want to go to.
Does it feel like a part of Chinatown, or does it feel like something superimposed on this place?
You know, it depends on what version of Chinatown you're talking about. You know, you have the art gallery Chinatown. You have the older traditional Chinatown that consists of this senior population. And then you have this new Chinatown that is being marketed, right? And Howlin' Ray's and Far East Plaza are a part of this new Chinatown.
Safe to say the older residents of Chinatown are not the ones waiting in line for 4 hours for hot chicken at Howlin' Ray's.
No, but you might find their grandchildren in that line.
So for this column, you bought a bunch of chicken and went around to local folks, local businesses, and literally just passed out the Howlin' Ray's. How did people react?
Yeah, everyone I talked to has been, you know, intensely curious about how the chicken tastes, and everyone has seen the line kind of curling out of Broadway, out of Far East Plaza sometimes, and everyone walks, so they see it every day. And so everyone was curious to try it, and there was someone who thought it was really tasty. There were some who thought it was, you know, unhealthy, which I guess is a reaction I should have anticipated, you know, feeding it to health conscious seniors.
I was interested in the reaction of the owner, who seemed very sympathetic to the locals who
may not be interested in or able to wait in line for his food.
Yeah, Johnny, when we got up to the counter, he gave us a big box of free chicken and wrote "for the people" on it and asked me to hand it out, you know. And I think in many ways he's heard a lot of the criticisms leveled at him, and in his own way he tries to help. You know, he tries to give out free chicken and be a part of the community in any way. And I think, you know, participating in this story was important to him because, you know, he wants to at least try to do that.
So do you think there is a way for well-intentioned people to bring investment and foot traffic to a neighborhood that has a long history without trampling on that history?
You know, that's a very difficult question, you know. Has any neighborhood really changed or gentrified and not lost something? And we have the type of economy that we do now where you can locate your restaurant in a neighborhood but not really have to interact with any of the residents of that neighborhood because your method of getting customers is through the internet or various different forms of marketing, and people will commute into your neighborhood who don't live there. And so you can have that type of situation now. And so it's more likely that we'll be able to change the way we interact with each other in these neighborhoods than change our entire economy.
Frank Shong writes for the LA Times. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ari.
And for people in Southern California who want some Howland Ray's chicken without waiting in an hours-long line, stand by. Owners Amanda and Johnny Rayzone have announced a second location in a larger space in Pasadena coming in 2020.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up next on Marketplace, from interest rates to inflation, looking at the big buzzwords from the Federal Reserve meetings this week. In the forecast, cloudy skies overnight tonight, chance of a shower late, lows around 60 degrees. More clouds tomorrow with possible showers and rain later in the day, and overnight, highs around 70 degrees. Right now, it is 73 degrees in Boston at 629. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Akamai, providers of their intelligent edge security platform for threat protection that comes with over 300 security researchers. Learn more at Akamai, akamai.com/security. Akamai, intelligent security starts at the edge. And Shakespeare and Company, Lenox, Massachusetts, presenting the romantic comedy Twelfth Night, directed by Alan Burroughs, on the main stage, July 2nd through August 4th. Shakespeare.org.